Soon he'll come to destroy all who stand against him. His kingdom's in the west, and it is there. You must go and make your stand. This is what God wants of you.
Welcome to this review of The Stand, part of the 3 Minute a Retrospective podcast, Stephen King Retrospective Series.
This isn't God's will or God's plan. It's a washout!
Join Garrett.
He's here just about every night.
Matt.
You stop talking, fuck, okay? You're talking yourself into getting shot.
And Adam.
Look, I thought he was your friend!
As they review both the 1994 and the 2020 adaptation of King's popular and epic novel.
I'm as scared of the likes of you!
Keep coming back, as the boys will review each Stephen King adaptation in publication order.
God has his finger on your heart.
So make your stand, podcast listeners.
Well, you're true, I've never been this scared.
The Percolated Media Stand Retrospective begins now.
If it's your will to bring him on, God, better do it before I lose my guts.
The Stand. It airs Sunday, May 8th, Monday, May 9th, Wednesday, May 11th, because no, you don't air over Roseanne, and Thursday, May 12th, 1994. It was viewed by over 50 million people. Yes, 50 million viewers watched The Stand, and it was directed by Mick Garris. All right, we are back discussing Stephen King after trudging through rows and rows of terrible Children of the Corn films. We took a little break, we talked some Marvel, and now we are getting back to King. Adam, how excited are you?
Oh, I had to sit for The Stand. That's what I'm, you know, yeah. Oh, goody. Hey, Adam, you get to watch one of the adaptations of King's longest possible books. Yay!
6-hour miniseries to start. Matt, had you read The Stand, sir?
No, because I looked at that thing in the bookstore and said, I don't have enough time on this planet to finish reading that. When I see a book and I can beat someone to death with it with only one full rotation of my arms, I'm probably not going to pick it up.
This book, oh boy. So this book actually marks the end of an era for Stephen King, because this was his fifth published book with Doubleday, and it marked his final published book with Doubleday, because after this he would jump publishers. After he turned in The Long Walk to Bill Thompson, the head of Doubleday Publishing, Thompson didn't buy that book, but he did see potential, so he picked him up for an option. They contracted King for 5 books. He turned in Carrie, he turned in Salem's Lot, he turned in The Shining. And while he was writing this, he went ahead and gave them Night Shift, which we spent all last year discussing and the year before. And after that was out, this was the fifth and final book of that contract. And King wasn't happy with this deal because, A, he thought he was underpaid, and B, he was not liking the fact that Bill Thompson was actually having him edit The Stand down. He turned in this manuscript and Bill Thompson was like, you got to take about 300-400 pages out of this because I can't sell a book this big. So he did. He took out 300-400 pages. It was released in 1978. Then it was released in paperback with some pages added to it. And then in 1990, he republished it with 400 added pages. So he got his manuscript out there. And then 4 years later, we had this miniseries. So this book went through a lot. When we left the old place, these guys know I was in a pretty dark place. I didn't have any editing to do. I was not in the best live-in situation. So every night I came home, every day I came home, I had both the original and 1990 version of this. To escape my live-in situation, guess what? I would come home, I would go in my room, and I would read The Stand. And I read both versions of that Stand in between the time we left that old place and the time we started up our current venture. So Matt, you may not have wanted to read it, but I read it twice and took a lot of notes, and here we are.
Longest book he's ever written.
Yes. Well, again, originally it wasn't. Originally it wasn't. I mean, the original version was about 800 pages. Then this version is
only 800 pages.
Well, this version was all about over 1,200.
I was just wondering if the current release is going to come with a hernia belt.
But I knew we were going to cover it eventually. That was back in 2021. So I read it. I took a lot of notes on it then. In the weeks leading up to this, I watched this miniseries twice, refined my notes, and here we are. So, Adam, you and I were friends in 1994. Was I ever talking about The Stand at that time? Did I bring the book to school? I probably did, right?
That's amazing. I could see you walking down the hallway like you're a character in one of King's books with this giant Bible-sized thing cradled under your arm. Thank God you're mid 6 feet, because you need someone the size to carry this home where they're going. Yeah, you did. And you're an apostate of King, and 30 years is what it took to get me to start paying attention to him as it started back then.
Yeah, except unlike a Jehovah's Witness, if you knock on someone's door with this book, you will break the hole in the door like Jack Nicholson did in The Shining, and you would be asked to leave, and the cops would come. Because, look, if I put this in my backpack during school, I would look like Quasimodo by the second semester. This thing is huge, and that's kind of why I've never touched it. Don't take any of the last two sentences I said and use them for future bloopers. But the only reason I read it, which is pretty lengthy, is because I actively wanted to. This, for some reason, I think part of it's because I'm so done with dystopian post-apocalyptic types of stories, especially like when I was growing up, zombies were still in vogue. And I feel like The Walking Dead, in a lot of ways, is very similar to The Stand in certain aspects.
I can see that.
The book length hasn't kept me away from it necessarily more than as much as King's name. You know, I think I've talked about it a bunch, but like I'm a fantasy reader. The Wheel of Time series is my go-to. And I think those average 900 pages per book, and there's 14 of those. But I think for a lot of people who think of King, I think maybe they think of him as pickup and read material. And this is more like forklift pickup and read material. The only version of it now is the current version, right? The 1,100, 1,200 pager?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the only one available now, yep.
What is that called, like the full version?
Complete Uncut is what they call it.
Which also applies to this miniseries, because this is also a commitment. The Shining was, what, 3.5 hours?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. This is double.
Well, almost double. It's not...
It's not almost. This also is why I've never seen the miniseries up until now. It's just, it's a commitment, and it's not a book I've read, but I do know it's spoken very highly of among King fans.
Yeah, this is still amongst his most popular works, is The Stand. A lot of people hold this as still their favorite novel of his. I'm not in that camp. We're going to get to my favorite relatively soon, actually, within the next couple years. But this book is held up by a lot of Stephen King fans as their favorite. I found in rereading it that there are parts, and we'll discuss it when we get into the movie, there are parts that are really, really good. And there are parts that completely drag. He has said that this is one of only about 2 or 3 times in his entire career where he got writer's block. And I'll discuss that part when we get to it. But you could definitely tell that he came to a point in writing this that he really didn't know where to go with it. And we kind of meander along with characters at certain points. And I don't think it justifies this 1,200 page length. And I know that's not really popular to say to King fans, but this is probably, it's probably in my top 10, but not necessarily my top 3.
And the only reason I know or have any peripheral knowledge is I know one of the characters in this ties into Dark Tower, which is a King property I am excited to talk about. More so the books. We'll get my thoughts on the movie when we get to that. But I do know there is that interconnectedness that stems from this. But also, look, when I see the name Mick Garrison, Stephen King, I kind of run the other way. When I knew this was coming, I procrastinated as long as I could.
This was one of the first ones that I knew of about with an interconnected universe. So with Matt's, you know, talk of, let's just call him the Man in Black. This is one of the first ones I knew of that I knew it had further reaching than just the novel.
Before we get to the actual miniseries, let's talk about the making of this, because this, like a lot of his properties around this time, had a pretty big journey to get to the screen. It started around 79 or 80. Stephen King brought along his buddy, and we're going to talk about this gentleman a lot in these next couple years. A guy by the name of George A. Romero. Matt, you mentioned zombies. He was given a lot of the credit for bringing the zombie genre to American cinemas, and he would work with Romero a lot, both with projects that were fulfilled and projects that weren't. This is one of those that was not fulfilled, but he brought George A. Romero on. They were going to do it as a feature-length film. They brought along a gentleman who we've discussed in the past, Matt. He wrote a little film called The Exorcist II Heretic, and he churned out a script that, oh my God. I read it in preparation for this. It is like J.J. Abrams Superman bad. It is so bad. There are things characters say in it. It doesn't sound like the same character. It is all over the place. But King and Romero were going to make it. I think King just kind of optioned it just because he needed a paycheck at that time. And that kind of lingered for a while. And then people came and went with this project until what I saw King say in an interview was he saw it on broadcast TV, and that's what gave him the gumption to make it an ABC miniseries. And so he got together with his buddy Mick Garris. They had just made Sleepwalkers, which we're also going to talk about here pretty soon. They hashed out this script, and Garris was the man who brought this to the small screen. And you know what? When this was released in 1994, this was an event for me and my father. I will admit to having a little bit of nostalgia for it because me and my father sat down, we watched all four nights of this, and we had deep discussions about it. This is something that I was very familiar with. I got it for Christmas, I believe the year after. I've watched it a number of times since, but before the viewing for this podcast, I probably hadn't seen it in close to about, I'd say about 6 years.
I've never seen this.
So you've never seen it. Adam, I'm guessing this was your first viewing as well.
Yep. Never seen it.
I also, for the record, I can't imagine trying to do this as a feature film.
I was going to ask you, how do you think that would have worked? George A. Romero directing a feature version of this?
Well, A, it would have been super truncated. The budget probably would not have been substantial enough because Romero worked best on smaller scales, because we saw once he got more money with his zombie films, they kind of lost their luster, if you ask me. So you're talking those two components. And I think with this many, I mean, there's like 100 plus roles in this.
Yeah.
So you would need an extra, if you want to get comparable actors, you'd have to spend a decent amount of money. So I just think from an efficiency standpoint, there's no way to do this. I mean, even it, when they did it in 2017, they had to split that into two movies. Mm-hmm. And this is even longer than that. So I don't know if there's any way you could do this as even a 3-hour movie. And maybe nowadays, I mean, we'll talk about the 2021, but if that didn't exist, maybe you could have done this as like a trilogy, The Stand Part 1, mm-hmm. Keep Standing, and I'm Still Standing, you know, call them that. But that's really the only way. As far as a singular entity, there's no way I could see this working as one movie.
Well, I will say that we're getting back into King, and I'm excited because we're discussing this. We're going to be discussing The Dead Zone. After that, we'll be discussing Firestarter. And then after we complete that series of films, we're going to get into Cujo, and we're closing it out with a podcast I am extremely looking forward to, which is The Running Man. So this is an era of King that I am super excited to discuss. Are we excited to discuss this 1994 TV miniseries? Well, guys,
no.
Whether we are or not, let's get going because we have a lot to discuss here.
Yeah, because the track record is so good up to this point. The Shining alone should disqualify me from having excitement about these miniseries.
Well, The Shining, let's not forget, The Shining came after this.
It did, but we had to watch it before.
Yeah.
And that was a good call on your part if you were going to get me excited to try and watch, 12 more of these miniseries?
No, maybe five.
Kissing, Matt wishes he was missing.
We start off with a quote from T.S. Eliot. It says that this is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. Not with a bang, but with a whimper. We cut to a barbed wire fence to a sign that says absolutely no trespassing, danger of death, and then a crow sitting on what it looks like a thermostat, and then he flies away as the title Stephen King's The Stand flashes on the screen. We see the subtitle The Plague as we cut to various points of reference this movie will turn to, including a suburb and a base that is blaring an alarm saying there has been a breach.
I was just going to say, as a big Resident Evil fan, I saw a lot of parallels. I was like, this is where the Umbrella Academy unleashed the T-Virus.
Wow. A guard is told to close the gate, so he runs home and tells his wife they need to leave with their baby. He squeezes between the gate and escapes. Now, I need to say something here, because in the complete unabridged version, this scene exists. In the original publication of this in 1978, we go to Stu and his friends at the gas station. So I want to ask you guys right now, do we really need to see this guard escape from this lab and get out in the open? Or would you have liked to have been like the New Hope entry where we are opening up and not really knowing where it's coming from?
The second, I had no idea what this movie, what this miniseries was even about. I knew it was post-apocalyptic, but I didn't know the catalyst. So I kind of would have liked to have been dropped into it without any explanation, because I think one of the problems with King that I've discussed in most of the properties we've done up to this point is sometimes his explanations are nowhere near as compelling as what your mind can hypothesize.
So you would like to have been just dropped right in?
Yeah, just they're sitting at the diner and then they stumble in.
I'm going to say something that I don't think you've heard me say here before. I love this King opening. I'm kind of like encapsulated by it right away. I'm drawn into it. A little scary based on world events that I'm sure we'll go over as we discuss this film, but I'm actually blown away right away. It sucks me in. I can appreciate the fact and I can see why getting dropped in would work. I don't think that would be a bad choice, but actually, I'm going to say it. I love what we get to open this film.
Wow. We hear the opening bars of Don't Fear the Reaper and cut to an opening sequence that has always stuck with me, as it was names surrounded by dead bodies. Now, I watched the commentary for this, and Mick Garris said on that commentary that they were given one mandate by ABC, and that was no open-eyed corpses were allowed to be seen. But he does something really funny here, where he kind of gave a middle finger to the network, because it cuts down to an open-eyed corpse when King's credit appears on screen, which I thought was really funny. But how do we feel about this opening title sequence, Don't Fear the Reaper?
Well, it's amazing how on the nose that is. I mean, this is miniseries, TV-type stuff. I love this. This is, I mean, you're playing this song, which is, it's a fun song to enjoy, but just seeing all this death, there's no doubt, you know, I'm flabbergasted. Again, I knew nothing about this. I didn't know the reason or anything else. So I feel like I'm watching an alternate version of the movie Contagion opening up here. Mm. Yeah, I am into this. It's boggling my mind that this is written at this point almost, it's like 45 years ago, almost 50 years ago now. And how relevant it is, but yeah, I'm digging the way this starts.
Yeah, musical choice notwithstanding, because I think that's too on the nose, but I can't accuse Mick Garris of subtlety whatsoever.
That was a King request. King actually really fought to have that put on there.
Well, regardless of who I can blame, I do think this is a provocative opening, and I was surprised at the, I don't want to say restraint, but for ABC, I mean, you don't, to see death on this scale on network television is something that you really, because look, around this time, we still had the fallout of the war in Iraq, the first one, and plenty of other horrible shit you can see on the news. So the fact that ABC, green, I mean, part of that is because it did so well with viewership. I'm sure ABC wanted another. Did this do as well as it did as far as audience tuning?
Yeah, 50 million.
A lot of people. So definitely was an event, and you know, I think this is a cool opening.
Yeah, I completely agree with you guys. Going to what they had to fight for, standards and practices was down their throat throughout this. They had to fight for almost everything. And Garris goes into it on the commentary, but he talks about the fact that they pretty much bargained. You could say son of a bitch twice, but no bastards here. There was stuff like that. Like, you could show this corpse, but don't turn him this way, turn him that way. By the time they got to The Shining, which we reviewed a few years ago, they were given more of a leniency, but here they had to fight for everything.
Yeah, it's really not that shocking, because I'm sure standards and practices made similar compromises with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh yeah, we'll talk about that when we get to it.
Yeah.
We see the crow land again as we fade to black. We cut to Hap's service, located in Texas, and here we get some good old boy talk with everyday people that some people, myself included, say is one of King's big strengths. We see a car crash outside. They run out and see the man from the opening in a dire way, with his face completely mangled by sickness, and he says that his wife and baby are sick. He says that he saw an evil man looking at him through the rearview mirror, grinning at him as he falls dead. And this is when we are introduced to one of our main characters, Stu Redman, played by Lieutenant Dan himself, Gary Sinise, just a couple months shy of his Academy Award nominee performance in Forrest Gump. I like him here. I think he has the everyday man quality down, and this was the perfect time to get him for this, as he encompassed this role very well. Me saying that, I don't like Stu that much as a character. The only reason I like Stu in this movie is because Gary Sinise. Matt, how do we feel about Gary Sinise in this film?
Well, I'm pretty much identical to you. I think he portrays the everyman really well. Let me say across the board, the acting in this is a pretty big step up from most of these miniseries, and even some of the movies that we've talked about. I mean, look, comparing this to Children of the Corn, it's not even a fucking debate. But I have yet to find one of these everyday type of main characters, these everymen that King likes to put at the forefront, that I really find compelling as a character. I feel like this guy is pretty similar to the Salem's Lot lead and characters like that. But also, can't really call him the main character, because there's like 100 fucking characters in this movie, in this miniseries. I think this is good casting, but I still don't find these white male leads that King runs with all that interesting just yet.
I think Gary Sinise is a really good choice. I don't know if I remembered or even knew that he was in that. I think most of the people in here I don't know, other than one or two that I knew were in this film. I know who they are. I think this thing is cast amazingly well, especially for a TV miniseries. To Matt's point, I think the acting is just really major steps above what we normally get. And Yeah, I think Sinise, he's more than just your everyman, but he's believable as an everyman. I wonder if you would have put him into that motel, into the hotel, could he have played in the Shining miniseries mm-hmm. instead? Was he believable in that? But I think he's as close to we get for King's wanting that everyman quality. But he does have an it factor to him. Haha, no pun intended. But as an actor, you know, he's got a little something. He's got a je ne sais quoi.
Well, speaking of actors who have a little bit of something, we cut to Ed Harris playing a general, giving a report of what he heard about what's been spreading, which they're saying is a type of flu, and there are zero chances of containing it. Now, Ed Harris, we're going to discuss him again when we get to Creepshow. He had been in King and Romero's Creepshow.
Needful Things.
Him and King actually established a friendship when they were in one of Romero's movies called Knight Riders together, which is about bikers. I don't recommend people checking it out. It's not very good. But they became very friendly, and Ed Harris, every time King has called him, he's always come running. He's a fan of King, and he wanted to do this, even if it's a very small role.
I had no idea he was in this, and it's funny how him and Gary Sinise, I immediately go to Apollo 13.
Yeah, right?
I mean, look, this movie should have the tagline, Houston, we have a problem.
Well, it was the year after this, so...
Yeah, I guess that was already taken, but I don't want to say I'm mad that they gave him this role, because I like Ed Harris in basically everything, but I feel like it's kind of a waste, because he's not in it a whole lot. But I understand there's so many freaking people in this. And I don't just say this because he played the Man in Black in Westworld, but I think he could have played Randall Flagg.
Ooh, Randall Flagg, that's interesting casting.
It's a really good call. Yeah. It's amazing you said we're going to discuss him more, and I was excited. I didn't know we had The Rock on the books.
Well, we're going to do a history of violence at some point.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But Ed Harris, yeah, I had no idea he was in it. I'm really glad to see him here. I don't mean to sound insulting that he brings a level of legitimacy, but I'm already seeing just people in this that I didn't expect, and it just makes me think that there's a quality level that I don't necessarily associate with some of these. And that can be insulting, take it for what it is, but there's just, I'm like, damn, I pay attention to his acting because he's got the chops.
So they come up with a cover story of saying it's actually a new strand of anthrax. We cut to flu medicine commercials. I love this. I had forgotten about this, but as soon as we get away from the Ed Harris scene, we go to this commercial that I legitimately thought where I was watching this, it was an actual commercial, but no, it's just a flu medicine commercial that they filmed for this movie.
I was upset. I was like, okay, they actually put commercials in this. I don't have a full 6 hours to watch. I didn't know I had commercials in my viewing.
And we're hearing people coughing as good old Joe Bob Briggs shows up. Speaking of people I wasn't expecting to see, he shows up as a police sheriff named Joe Bob.
This miniseries will give you a whiplash. Half the time you're like, hey, it's that guy, or I love that person. And then other times it's like, what the fuck are they doing here? This was more of the second.
He's saying that there might be a quarantine coming up. And then the two guys say that it must just be the sniffles. Joe Bob sees some military vehicles driving by and calls in about them as he also comes up with a cough. They build a quarantine zone as the crow lands on a sign. We then see some kids playing basketball, and they have their ball run over by the trucks, which was a nicely added scene. As we see the dad from ALF. Max Wright.
That's exactly what I went to.
Yep. Now, this poor guy, don't Google him, because he didn't really have a really good last few years of his life. But he shows up to take Stu and his family away. He says that if they have what his friends had, then they're dead already, which I thought was a nice
thing. His life trajectory matched the last few seasons of ALF.
Yeah, right. What I liked about this, I think Sinise really comes to play here, because at one point he looks at this guy who's trying to take him away and say that he doesn't know what he's dealing with. And then Stu looks at him and says, the South doesn't mean I'm dumb. I thought that was a nice line.
Mm-hmm.
So Max Wright, he shows up to the quarantine spot in a mask and says that details are forthcoming, and they walk the group out as Stu says that he thinks they're in big trouble. So we go from the Stu storyline, we cut to Larry Underwood, played by Adam Stork, as his song Baby Can You Dig Your Man plays on the radio. Okay, so this character was the character that the network really pushed to have Rob Lowe play. Both Garris and Rob Lowe said, you know what, I want to play the Nick Andros role. So they gave it to this guy, Adam Stork. I think he's fine. But this character in the book, there are so many things that are really compromising that guy and what he really wants to do. I don't think this guy puts that across. I think this is kind of a weak link of the cast.
I feel like there's something there that doesn't translate maybe necessarily to screen. So yeah, maybe that's part of it. I don't know. It seems wishy-washy back and forth. And the Larry we get by the end of this isn't the Larry that I feel like we're getting here. Maybe that's the point. But he doesn't... He's one of the few characters that I don't feel a draw to.
This is one of the fundamental problems when you have an ensemble this big is there's almost always going to be one, if not weak link, which can sometimes be an exaggeration, a sub-story that you don't gravitate to. And this is kind of it for me, where the actor's okay, but I don't really care about following a failed musician. And I really don't care about the romantic, quote-unquote, interest he develops with another character. And, like, the only thing I know this guy from is Mystic Pizza.
Oh, God. That's right.
Mm-hmm. The only other thing I recognize this guy from. So I was like, anytime he was on screen, look, when I'm yearning to watch Rob Lowe over you, there's a good chance that it's pretty freaking bad.
Another side note, this fucking song. Now, King, he puts himself out there as, he will be the first to tell you, he is an aspiring failed musician, as he likes to say. And the lyrics of this song are all over the book, and this song is all over this movie. And this is like one of those, Adam, remember when we were in high school and VH1, they wouldn't play like MTV type videos. They play like songs like this. That's what I thought of, is this song would be a hit if it was on VH1.
Yes.
Yeah, this might as well be an outtake from Behind the Music.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. King, for not going into music. I haven't seen 2020's The Stand yet, but I hope to God that this character is better in that one. In the book, it also shows that King really had aspirations with this character, because an awful lot of time is spent with him in the book, as he probably saw himself as this guy who was successful in music, being an offshoot of what he would have been like. But again, this song is terrible. God, I sing better in the shower than how this song is.
A high bar to cross.
It doesn't come into play. Like, the music part of it just doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So to start it this way means it should be a hook later on, and it's not. And it makes no sense.
I thought it was going to be where he writes a song that's going to save the world, and I was like, oh, no.
No, this is not a nice Shyamalan. And fuck you, Matt. I heard that, dick. We see Larry just really digging, hearing himself saying, "Baby, can you dig your man?" as he gets out of his car and rings the doorbell to his mom's house. But mom's not really happy to see him, though she lets him in anyway. He says he had to get out of L.A. for a bit, and his mom responds with her back's not really feeling that well. Larry says that he's not in too much trouble, but he does need to borrow a little bit of money, $40,000 to be exact. She says that he's just like his father, and she'd like to see the real person come out of him at some point. He says that once his record hits the top 100, he's going to be rich and famous. She hugs him and tells him, "Welcome home." So we then cut to inside the research facility as we see someone choking to death, and the researchers say that the virus works so damn fast. Stu gets up, seemingly unaffected by the virus. And then we cut to a small town in Maine as Harold Lauder, played by Adam Parker Lewis himself, Corin Nemec. He's here to see if Francine is home. Now, Adam, this was around the time that, for the first time in my life, I was finding myself feeling old. What I mean by that is, we had both seen Molly Ringwald and Rob Lowe be a part of the Brat Pack, but here we're in a new decade now, and here they are trying to portray real characters in a Stephen King miniseries. They were still cool in my eyes, but here Molly's all grown up. But now we have Parker Lewis and Molly Ringwald. Adam, how are you feeling about this?
What? Yeah, Corin Nemec, he's always going to be Parker. I watched all of Parker Lewis Can't Lose. That was just the show, so I can't see him as something else. Molly Ringwald. Okay. Obviously, know her from a lot of stuff, going all the way back to the Breakfast Club, yada, yada. I am really glad to see her in this. And I may have seen her on a poster somewhere. I like her in this a lot. I like her look. I like that they were actually smart enough to get rid of the red hair, which would have just tied her into so many 80s things. I think Molly is one of the standouts, at least for these first part that she's in the show. I like her a lot. I just can't stand Harold. Right off the bat, I know Harold's going to be a problem.
Lewis Can't Lose. Are you fucking kidding me?
What do you know this guy from?
Stargate.
Oh, he's Stargate. In Stargate. Yep. That's right. Yep.
Harold is the one character where I could telegraph his entire trajectory for this whole 6 hours. And on the Molly Ringwald note, she's good, but I just find her presence distracting. Because this is no fault of her own. I just can't get the John Hughes stuff out of my head.
Yeah, she had a legitimate chance to put the John Hughes stuff behind her when David Lynch offered her Blue Velvet and she turned it down.
Yeah, I'm sure she still regrets it.
Yeah, this was 8 years after that. I think she was really trying to legitimize herself. She's been around. She did a one-woman play when I was living in L.A. I actually attended. She's okay, but Harold's one of those characters that, well, I'll talk about that as we get into it, but he is very complicated in the book, and it's surprising to me that King has actually written him like this in this miniseries. It is much different than how he is in the book, but I'll get to that when we get into him proper. But this Francine character, she's a college student in the novel. So we'll get to Lo a little bit later. But Adam, I'll go with you. I like Molly Ringwald in this. And she took a beating in this miniseries. Fans have been all over her. A lot of people don't really like her performance as Francine. But I'm like you, Adam.
I think she brings a sweetness to it without being overly innocent. I don't find her naive. I think she plays it well.
So Fran comes out to meet Harold, who's full of pimples, and he shows that one of his poems made it into a magazine, and she tells him congratulations. He asks her out to a Bergman festival, but Fran says that her and Amy already had plans to go to an REM concert, just really stamping this into the 90s. Harold then storms off, and we learn from Fran's dad that Harold has had a crush on her since he was 9 years old.
Well, you say dated, but this movie might as well be subtitled Losing My Religion with the huge...
Oh my God, yes.
What's in this? So REM is more topical than you want to give it credit for.
Yeah, we'll get to that when we get to Night 4. This definitely turns into a Christian movie at some point.
I swear to God, I thought PureFlix was behind this at one point.
So Fran's dad asks about Jess, and she responds that her and Jess have decided to spend some time apart. But her dad says that there are still times that he thinks a lot about her mom, and he's trying to get over it, but it's tough as he breaks down and coughs. We cut back to Stu, who says that he doesn't want any more tests and that he wants to talk to a doctor. Dad from Alf walks in wearing a hazmat suit, and Stu asks for information on why he isn't sick, and he wants answers.
I know her dad from Scrubs.
Yeah, I know Adam does too.
Sure do.
And his aunt being Katharine Hepburn.
Mm-hmm. I like her dad though, in this, though. It's one of the most heartbreaking instances in this series, is what happens to him.
After seeing so much King and paying attention to it recently, when I see this medical facility, all I could think of is the shot. And when I think of the virus getting released, I go to that also. And I just wish it was a little more tied in that way.
We cut to Arkansas on June 20th as we see Nick Andros getting attacked and beaten up. He gets thrown on the street and...
We all wanted to do to Rob Lowe at some point.
Oh my God, around this time he was still recovering from that scandal. Adam, remember that scandal he was in?
Yeah, that was the best acting he's ever done, where he told his wife, fuck that movie.
Yeah, I mean, everybody knows that joke, right? And what's Rob Lowe's best movie? Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we'll talk about Sex, Lies, and Videotape version a little later too. So... Nick gets thrown on the street and picked up. Now, Nick Andros is played by previously mentioned Rob Lowe. Boys, we covered him when we did 2004 Salem's Lot a couple years ago, but Lowe was at a real point of his career at this point. As I mentioned, it was only 6 years before that a video of him having sex with an underage girl and her friend was released to the public, and he needed to rethink his image. He really wanted this role of Nick, as he had read the book and thought he could do better things with it than the Larry Underwood character, which he was originally offered. But he begged Garris and the network until he got the role. And you know what? I do like him. He is actually deaf in his right ear in real life, which I think helped him in this performance. I do think we lost something when Stork took the Underwood role. But as far as Nick Andros and the relationships and such that he develops throughout the course of this film, I think he's very good and he doesn't really need to say a thing. I think this was a pivotal role in his career because little by little, he got more roles until he landed on The West Wing, which is Matt's favorite show. And that was a career changer for him. But this was the first time people actually took Lowe serious. Boys, what do we think of Nick Andros?
Not seeing him in a whole lot, I could say. I'm currently making my way through Parks and Rec for the first time, and I kind of wish he would leave that show already. I've not seen The West Wing. I know, much to Matt's chagrin. I swear, I promise it's on my list. Let me finish The Sopranos. But I like Rob Lowe in this. Maybe it's just because all of his acting is being done without being able to speak, but...
I'm a joke.
Damn it. But I think he is acting really well for being able to be a mute. Maybe it's because of that and what the choices he's got to make, but I like him.
He's better here than he was in Salem's Lot, which is not a high bar to cross.
But yes.
I guess the fact that he's deaf in his right ear makes a lot of sense. That's why he couldn't hear the police coming to break up that sex tape.
Well, he can't hear cut most of the time.
So we see Nick in a cornfield.
Oh. And I said, oh no.
Oh no.
Well... Let's talk about this. Now, I mentioned way back when we did Children of the Corn 2020 that, yes, we were going to come back to King and we were going to get away from Children of the Corn. But guess what? There is a lot of steam behind a fan rumor that Randall Flagg, the man in black, is actually the man behind the rose.
I could see that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know what? I'm actually okay with that. I'll save them.
That's one piece of headcanon that I don't despise.
But when this happens, I hit info on my remote to make sure that the TV didn't freaking switch on me.
Yeah, but as soon as this fucking cornfield showed up, I said, oh no.
This is where we are introduced to Mother Abigail, played by Ruby Dee, and we find out that Nick can actually talk here, which I think is one of Rob Lowe's bad moments in this series, is when he's actually, I can talk! So this
they should have done the thing from Planet of the Apes, the musical of The Simpsons with I Can Sing.
So this is the good portion of the good and evil aspects of this movie. We learn that Mother Abigail is 106 years old and that she's lived in Nebraska all her life. She then says that Nick needs to bring all of his friends as we cut to a scarecrow in the form of a character we are going to meet a little bit later, and Nick wakes up in a jail cell.
It's weird to have a positive depiction of religion in a Stephen King movie, which made me believe that he did not write this.
Well, you give him a little bit of credit. Jesus Christ.
Well, I did. I said, it's just, I think this is actually taking a lot of the tropes that I think he's done pretty poorly, like the supporting black character, which we'll talk about in a couple of movies coming up. Obviously, the preacher, clearly with a Christian basis. I think this is actually handled a lot more delicately than I thought he was capable of. Because this could have been disastrous in a lot of ways. Both from the evangelical side, who wanted to critique it, and from the racial component side. And if you don't like ageism, you could have attacked this. Because, I mean, this could have been like Aunt Jemima level of ridiculous.
You're right. Yeah, I think the Mother Abigail character is handled very well, too. Although not in the book. In the book, she is introduced right after she finishes moving her bowels, which took me by surprise. Thought we were done talking about Matthew Vaughn, but here we are with scatological humor. So
the Mandarin all over again.
We cut to some cops as one of them coughs. The doctor checks him out as Nick doesn't respond, and they conclude that he must be deaf and dumb. We then cut to Vermont Disease Control, and Ed Harris swears that this super flu does not exist. Boy, you know what? Adam, you already brought it up, but goddamn, how much of the things that have happened in the last 5 years did you think about while watching this?
God, holy shit.
Man.
He was almost prophetic.
Yeah, this gave me PTSD. Stuff.
And I can't believe the follow-up to this, the remake, came out in 2020.
I know.
That they decided to release it. That they didn't decide to hold it for a year or two.
Well, they barely finished... we're going to talk about this a lot next week. They had finished filming
it
about 3 weeks before the whole world shut down. So... there was a lot of shit going on at that time. We see another doctor introducing Stu to Geraldo the Rat, who has been breathing the same air as him and is also just fine. The doctor tells Stu that they need to resume the testing on him and that all the people he came in here with are now dead.
I was really worried that this was going to be another Chosen One type of story because they're saying like, oh, he's immune. He's the key to saving everybody. Like, I didn't want this to be the fucking Last of Us again. I'm thankful it doesn't go that direction because it's setting me up to think that's where it's going as a newcomer.
Stu fakes a cough so that the doctor can get a taste of what it is like on the outside, and we quest he gets the hell out of there. We're hearing through newscasts that the flu rumor is gaining traction, and this is a great way to show what the world consensus is as we follow these characters.
I feel something real about the way this is being done. I mean, definitely more in hindsight now, but to get this so correct in 94, I don't know how it was written, is nicely on point.
Speaking of characters I don't want to follow, we see Larry talking to his girlfriend who tells him that this Captain Trips flu is freaking everyone out and she doesn't want to go out tonight. Larry is stopped in a bar by two bizarre-looking individuals as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar also stops Larry and said that they're coming for you.
Kareem.
Yeah. Wow. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was actually friends with Richard Rubenstein, who is George A. Romero's longtime producer and is also a producer of this. And Kareem was also a King fan, and he came on to do this role, and Matt said it. We have over 100 speaking roles here. Why not just put Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in the middle of that?
How is it he gave a more dignified performance in Airplane than this? Because that movie's a comedy. Like, this took me out completely.
Really?
Because of who it is. Because like everyone else is actors. Now you have this 7-foot, super recognizable athlete preaching the end of the world. The 90s was not a good time to be the Lakers, so he was kind of predicting that, at least until they got Kobe and Shaq, but... in a movie about a fast-spreading virus, Magic Johnson's like, no, I'm not being involved in that.
Well, you know why it was a good idea to have him, though, is because the production team was given permission to film in Times Square. They were given permission to film in New York. How the hell are you going to film a dystopian place destitute of people in New York? Well, they found a way around it. What they did was, if you notice, when we see Kareem later, we see him from the legs up. If you show him from the waist up, you hide everybody else around him. So it actually looks like the place is destitute. So he came in handy while filming these scenes. So we see Miguel Ferrer, who is part of a duel of bandits, stop and hold up a store. We have a very rapidly cut scene of this attempted robbery as Miguel Ferrer's partner is shot, and he spots a crow on a light pole. He's laid down and cuffed. We're hearing about some flu issues from Wyoming. Now, this is how King explains it in the novel. In the novel, we are basically going from somebody going to the airport to somebody who was on the plane to somebody who was walking the street. All of them come back with flu symptoms, which is very, very scary to read when I read this at the end of 2021, given what we had gone through the year before.
So it came from the Langoliers? It came from that freaking airport?
To be discussed at a later date. We cut to a news crew stop being a part of the military, and we're getting this real footage type scene of them getting shot. I completely forgot about this scene, and I have to say it's way ahead of its time. I like this scene a lot. We're then seeing Nick in jail getting propositioned from the guys who beat him up from the cell inside. Nick opens one of their cells and he puts a gun on him. The guy spits on him and makes his way out.
I'm sure that's not the first time Rob Lowe has been spit on. But it's probably the first time he was spit on wearing clothing.
Usually by request.
My God, you guys are really tough on Rob Lowe here.
Considering we had to watch Salem's Lot, I think it's kind of weird.
We cut to Queens, New York, as we see Larry go to his mom's amongst a massive war zone. And I have to say, this has always been one of my worst nightmares. It was to come home and see one of my parents like this and see them die in front of me. If it had been a better actor, it would be harrowing. But just the idea and how King wrote this has lived with me. And of course, this is more played up in the book.
It's tough. And what I like here at this beginning, well, throughout the entire thing, is that we're getting dates. And if you pay attention, this society is rapidly declining. Wait, it's a sprint. It is not a long road. You like that? Yeah, it is a sprint.
Yeah, it's not a long walk.
Yeah.
To watch society start to crumble. But yeah, this is kind of ridiculously effective, especially when we don't know the what and the why of any of it as of yet. So to see just some people immune and other people die around them is intriguing.
Yeah, it's fine. But again, as much of a step up in the acting as on the whole, there are still those kind of hokey moments scattered throughout. And I think a lot of that's just because of Mick Garris's direction.
I think this is Mick Garris's shining moment, to not make a pun. But I think there are moments when we do see his direction kind of lacking. But I think for the most part, he had a 50-day shoot here. And I think for the most part, he holds the production up pretty well, especially this first night. I'll go ahead and say this first night, when people say that The Stand isn't a horror novel, I think this first night and what happened in the world being decimated is a horror story. And I think he's filming this pretty well. And it's probably my favorite part of the entire series is this first night. So we cut to some looting. Don't forget, this was only a couple years after the LA riots, as we see that Ed Harris has shot himself. Yeah.
Was not expecting this. Oof.
We see the doctor who was nice to Nick die in his car as Nick is attacked yet again.
This is like when Andy Dufresne keeps getting raped by the same person. It's like this guy can't catch a break.
We see Fran attend to her dad, and what the hell is Jewish penicillin? I don't know.
I'm not going to say it.
Again, another harrowing set of scenes as yet another kid sees their parent die in front of them. And then speaking of things I wasn't expecting to see, here we have a Kathy Bates cameo.
Wow. This, I actually had to pause my TV because as far as I knew, her first role wasn't coming yet, right?
No, oh, this wait, was no, four no, years was after she won the Oscar.
This was after.
Yeah.
Okay. You know what? It's because I think of the book. I keep thinking of the date of the book. But she's not credited originally in this. This is just a uncredited cameo. And I was just like, holy shit, that is Kathy Bates.
Yeah, because Ed Harris isn't credited either.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, Kathy Bates, she had been a pretty big stage actress before she took the Misery role. But of course, she was indebted to that role. It gave her an Oscar and she wanted to pay it back. And she volunteered to do this role without any credit. She showed up for, I think Mick Garris said, for about 4 hours, filmed the scene, and went ahead and left. In the book, it's actually a male. This is a radio show host who does pretty much what Kathy Bates does in the scene, but I like seeing her, man. It was good to see her in this limited role that she has.
I think it's good because you recognize it as an Easter egg just to previous King's work. She still delivers a good job, and it's just, it's universe time. It's the perfect kind of Easter egg cameo for this.
And then we get our first real scene of human form, Randall Flagg, as he knocks out a deer, and we see some red eyes form in his head. More on this character later. We cut to Stu in Mother Abigail's cornfield. He walks up to her and says that he was lost and heard the sweet sounds of her guitar. He hears some noises and turns to see the fields are black, and these fields are probably the worst set of this entire film. I hate this set. Oh, boy.
I hated him throughout 12 films, so yeah.
Yeah, now anytime I see a corn husk, I'm going to get mad.
Stu then looks up at Flagg, who kind of roars at him, and he wakes up, which this was a pretty big jump scare.
This just felt really out of place. Especially that fucking demon makeup that we keep seeing multiple times.
Oh, yes. More on that later. But you know what? This is from Stephen King, so you got to put some horror in this series, I guess. So the doctor shows up in Stu's room sick and pulls a gun on him. Stu knocks him down with his remote, and we get a fight as Stu knocks him out with a kick. He then grabs the gun and starts making his way out of the facility. The doctor attacks again and is shot twice. So Stu again makes his way out, and Garrus is playing up the jump scare quotient with how many dead bodies Stu is running into. Another doctor attacks, and Stu is finally out of the building. He finds himself amongst Mother Abigail again, as she says that you and your friends need to come see me. We see Stu walking the streets, and boys, this is when part one ends. Overall, how do we feel about part one of this series?
I'm blown away by part one. My notes on here, because I separated them by parts, was part one, wow.
Wow.
I was brought into it in a world that I didn't know, hadn't read it, a lot of stuff that I wasn't expecting, a little too close to reality that it's even more unnerving, which may heighten it, but I like the acting, I like the direction. There's some hokey parts, there's some people I don't necessarily like, but I think it's a really good setup for the journey that we're getting. It's 90 minutes. It's amazing that this is almost, it's a feature-length film just for this first part, but it's effective, and I didn't really feel that it was 90 minutes other than a few little spots.
Yeah, it's definitely better than I thought it would be. I mean, it's a lot of setup. You're starting to show how fast the world is going to fall. So I thought it was well done. And it did a surprising thing where I wanted to know what was going to happen next. That was the most surprising part.
We move on to part two, the dreams, as Fran is preparing to bury her dad and is singing Amazing Grace. We then see Harold pull up and help Fran take her dad's body downstairs and into the garden. Fran pours Harold some lemonade, and she says that this place seems like a different planet from where she grew up. They decide they need to go to Vermont and head to the disease center. Fran then uses the dreaded F word to someone pining for a female friend, and she tells Harold that they're always going to be friends. She puts on The Dream Is Over as Harold just can't help himself, and this is funny because this King had written in a Beach Boys song to be played here. I don't remember exactly which one it was, but I know he wrote it in as kind of an irony of the world is being destroyed and Harold wants to put on this Beach Boys song, but it was Mick Garris' idea to put Crowded House on. And I think it works well for the scene, and King even said himself on Mick Garris' podcast that, yeah, he agreed with that decision to change that up. So we cut to more destruction caused by the flu as Larry is trying to call for help. Larry then runs into Nadine Cross, played by Laura San Giacomo, and oh boy, what an interesting character this is. This is actually a combination of characters. This is Nadine and a character named Rita that Larry runs into that he has to kill in the book. This is that character rolled into one. This actress had made her mark 7 years before in Sex, Lies, and Videotape. I don't like her very much here.
Somebody that I recognize, I like seeing her. She's got a presence. I'm never feeling comfortable around her. Like, I'm always just uneasy because I know that there's something more there. But I think when we start getting some people together, we start getting classic pretty people syndrome, and that always just throws me off, especially when you're in the middle of a pandemic that killed 99.4% of all people.
Yeah, don't forget to put your makeup on in the midst of that.
Yeah, and with Adam, this is definitely the worst example of we got to put people together just because they're attractive, even though these people should start looking like the rejects from Mad Max in a couple of days.
Yeah, this character, I have issues with the way this character is handled, because even in the book, I don't really like it. In the book, she is destined to be with Randall Flagg. She moved a Ouija board in the book. Yes, she moved a Ouija board, and it told her to pretty much save herself for Randall Flagg. And she is destined to do that, which is why later on when Larry wants to have sex with her, she doesn't really want to, although she'll do anything else. But here, the character is not really written that well, both in the book and in the series. And boys, wait till you see who plays her next week. We'll get there. So Larry makes Nadine a steak, and she responds that she's lost her appetite. Larry invites her to go with him, and she accepts. He says that they need to head west to Nebraska because he's been having dreams about an old black woman named Mother Abigail. She says that she doesn't dream, but images are shown that tell us differently, and we see more hints of Randall Flagg. We see the Miguel Ferrer character, Lloyd. He's calling for help inside a jail cell, as all other inmates are now dead. Before we cut to good old Lawnmower Man 2 alum, Matt Frewer, the guy we'll eventually know as Trash Can Man, running around Indiana setting fires to factories while hearing voices in his head, including that of Randall Flagg himself. This Trash Can Man had almost no presence in the originally published novel, back in 1978, King added about 100 or so pages of him in the revised version in 1990. He is a crazy character. I like the way that Matt Frewer is playing him, because this is actually how he is in that book. And when we see him later, he's got scars and he's been exposed to radiation. He is shown to go a little crazy. Adam, how do you feel about Trash Can Man here?
Just don't know what to make of him. He's just running around, setting fire, trash with bomb, I guess just to show that he's crazy. But, I mean, I guess it's just to show anybody can be immune from this virus. It's like they're setting him up for something, and then he's forgotten about till the very end of this miniseries. He's all over the place. But I think that Frewer does a decent job with what this character is supposed to be. I just don't know if I even need this character in a miniseries that has so many.
Yeah, this feels kind of superfluous in the grand scheme.
We cut to Hemmingford, Nebraska, as Mother Abigail walks up to her house and says that once every generation a plague will befall over man. And she adds, that's what it says in the book. She sees rats hanging around her fields and doesn't take that as a good sign. She then starts singing before she's visited by Randall Flagg, once again shown at a distance before his eyes turn red, and he causes her to bleed as she strums the guitar. This is a scene that has always stuck with me. It scared me when I watched it initially in its first run, but I don't know. I like seeing the presence that Randall Flagg has here.
I like seeing Flagg at this point. I don't know what to make of it. I mean, his outfit and such is enough that it's almost jokey. I can't see anything with Mother Abigail without thinking of the Oracle from The Matrix.
Oh, yeah.
I just can't. It's hard for me to get past that. I mean, if Laura walked in the room when I'm watching this and goes, is that the Oracle? And she was not kidding, because it just has that feel of the way that she does everything. It's fine, but I mean, we're setting up heaven and hell, so I get it. Which means, I guess, the cornfield is Earth, and you know what? That pisses me off even more now, damn it. Mm. I guess we're the rats. So I like the concept, but when I see Flagg decked out in denim on denim on denim, just come on, man.
Yeah, all I need is a handlebar mustache to complete that look.
Now, guys, remember when I said the casting of Larry was one of this film's biggest faults? Well, meet the biggest fault, the casting of this Jamie Sheridan as this film's main villain, who we are supposed to fear. Now, I can excuse Larry because he's not a pivotal head of the group in this battle of good versus evil, but Randall Flagg is the head of the evil side. We should fear him. But this Sheridan waltzes in the scenes. He's wearing blue jeans and denim, as Adam mentioned. He's got these red eyes with the sole intent of us fearing him. I fear his fashion, but I don't fear this character, who is also a huge part of the Dark Tower universe, as we'll talk about. He's supposed to embody everything we're afraid of, but all he embodies to me is where to throw my venom. It's a damn shame that they couldn't get this character right. I hope to hell they get this right next week, but what do you guys think of our Randall Flagg?
Probably the biggest misstep in this whole miniseries, and it's a huge, he's a linchpin of this story. So for that to be as much of a performance misfire as it is, doesn't cripple the movie, but it's a wounding blow. I said Ed Harris would have been perfect for this. Looking at this cast, and I read some of the names they wanted, and the one that stood out to me was David Bowie. I totally could see that. Willem Dafoe was mentioned. I mean, that's borderline typecasting.
I would have liked Willem Dafoe. I would have even liked the other name that they mentioned, Jeff Goldblum. I think he could have been pretty good here.
They were looking for, like, A-list actors. Mm-hmm. Walken was brought up. It's funny to mention James Woods as an A-lister, but they looked at him. They looked at Lance Henriksen. None of them were available, so they just found this guy in one movie. And King liked him in the readings, but I'm like, King, this is why you should stick to your lane. You're not a casting director. Yes. Because I think David Bowie, especially like for a character who leads a cult of like worship, and he has to be very charismatic, but there also has to be something off-putting about him, that screams David Bowie. This is pretty bad. And I haven't seen next week's miniseries, but I read who plays him there, and I'm like, okay, that tracks much more.
Yeah, I feel like you need both sides. I don't know if he's the Antichrist or the devil or a demon. I like, nothing's ever exactly fleshed out completely, but he needs to be charismatic and scary and walk both sides of that fence. And he's sitting in a lawn chair, not really walking either side of that fence. Bowie would be a good choice if you were to do out in the night. Kurt Russell.
Yeah.
You know, somebody like that with the same face and hair.
Val Kilmer.
Oh, God. So I think you have choices of people. And I get they didn't want a name to be recognizable or a face to be recognizable. But there's enough quality genre type actors that could do this better. Yeah, I just think he's cast poorly. And I think some of the choices they make with his wardrobe, line deliveries, and a fucking mask don't really do him any favors.
Yeah, the Party City mask.
Yep, check off that note later. Mew. Payback.
So Flag then visits Floyd, and he then makes a Bugs Bunny reference and says that Floyd looks like Kaka. He reveals the rat that Floyd's been eating and tells him that his luck is about to change. He makes a key appear David Copperfield style and introduces himself, saying that he's going to take Floyd out for a cheeseburger and fries and tells him that he has picked Lloyd as his foreman. He also makes him promise that he won't backstab Flag before Flag gives him the key. We then cut to the Lincoln Tunnel in New York City, and this was a scene that really got to me when I read it. This was one scene when I initially read this book that I had to close. It terrified me. The idea of going through a long and super dark tunnel full of dead bodies has stayed in my head since I first read it. Not to mention, Nadine is insufferable here as she just abandons Larry in this tunnel. But this scene, it's scary in the book. I don't think it comes off as scary in the miniseries. They do what they can here. But Matt, is this at all harrowing to you, seeing them go through this tunnel?
Yeah, especially, but it would have been more terrifying if they cut the audio and there was like no silence. I mean, if there was no sound.
Yeah.
Like all you hear is their footsteps.
I'm kind of bored at this part. I get the reasoning for it, and I even know where they are. The tunnel's important. Like, I get it. But this feels just filler. It's just I don't know. I want a little more out of this. We literally just had the angel and demons meeting each other before, and this just, it's flat for me. I do like it being just the dead bodies you got to get through. There's something eerie about that, but it's just, I don't know, move it along.
Larry passes by some dead motorists while holding the flashlight, and of course, we hear him talking to himself. He watches as one of the corpses says his name, or does he? Larry's flashlight is then dropped, so he turns on his lighter and continues on. But he drops the lighter too, so he gets turned around and pulls out his gun, shooting in the dark, and then he hears Nadine's voice. He finds her, as she says that she felt the wind of bullets that he shot. They emerge from the tunnel, and Larry says, "Jersey never smelled so good." Meanwhile, Stu, he runs into Glenn Bateman, who of course is singing, "Baby, Can You Dig Your Man?" Now, Glenn also has a dog named Kojak. I like this character of Glenn. He brings a welcome presence every time he's on screen. This guy, me and Adam probably know him best as Mr. Hand from Fast Times at Ridgemont High. But I like this character a lot. He brings some levity here.
I like him throughout this entire, I like his presence. This is just like you're sitting with a family member. You know, it's just, there's something very calming there. I love his introduction. Mm-hmm. Because in the wake of everything that is going on in the world, he is sitting there painting. He's finding art in tragedy, and I just find there's something beautiful about that while all this is going on. But this is a character that he sticks with me throughout.
Well, he's also one of the few characters where I buy his profession before the world went to shit, because he was a professor. I'm like, okay, that definitely tracks.
We cut to Pipersville, Pennsylvania, as Larry and Nadine, they seemingly are getting it on until Nadine says that she just can't. Larry says that he wants her, but she says that she needs more time, which he grants.
Well, you got 4.5 hours to go, so.
All right, so this lethal weapon type jazzy score going on here. King said that he wanted quote-unquote blue jeans music for this, although Mick Garris pushed for more orchestral stuff. They got this guy who worked on Wonder Years. Don't get me wrong, I love the music in Wonder Years. I really don't like the music in this series. I think it falters. There are times when I'm kind of with it, but that's only when they bring in more orchestral stuff. When they just go with the strumming guitar, I'm kind of out.
It's completely forgettable to me. Normally, I'm one of the music guys when we're discussing this. Other than the needle drops, everything else I can't even remember, and I just watched this 2 days ago. So there you go.
We cut to Larry moving through the cornfield shirtless as he talks to Nadine in his sleep. She dreams that she's in the arms of Flag in a terrible backdrop as he says that he needs her to hide her mind from the old woman until she gets to him, and Flag tells her to leave Larry behind before threatening her with scary cat eyes.
Yeah, it's the sleepwalkers
effect. Yes, I thought of that too. Larry then wakes up and finds a letter from Nadine who says that he was right about the dreams. We then cut to May Place, Oklahoma, as Nick is taking a bicycle through the village before Tom Cullen, played by Coach and SpongeBob SquarePants own Bill Fagerbakke. Now, I feel that this guy is just playing Dauber all over again.
Dauber!
Yes, Dauber.
Okay. I understand that this is, I'm sure this is how he's written in the book.
Yes.
Tom Collins?
Yeah.
Okay. To have him spend so much time with Gary Sinise.
He's Lenny from Mice and Men.
Thank you. I can't stop thinking of Mice and Men, and they're together. But I mean, he's perfect for this role. I always feel bad though, he's typecast as this. I mean, it's so on the nose, but I think he's effective in what he does. He's a presence that makes me smile. And my entire life, I have heard M-O-O-N, that spells, and I have never, ever known what the hell it's from.
You didn't know it was from this?
No. So at 40, how old am I? 46 years old, I have finally figured out where the hell it comes from.
That's so funny.
Yeah, he had his Captain America moment of, oh, I understood that reference. I'm glad this was not the Lawnmower Man 2.0, because that's where my brain went. I'm like, oh God, we're going to have another questionable depiction of mental illness. It's weird. It's clear he's got a disability, but he's also not dim enough to be what I would classify as like retarded. So I think it's fine. It's just, there's certain incidents where I feel like the characters are here because King's like, oh, it's a trope, I got to put it in. So well, of course, you got to have the mentally disabled person in this gang.
Well, this is actually... Believe it or not, this character is actually based on a real person.
King's
mom was a caretaker. And when he was a teenager, he met somebody at that hospital exactly like this character who would do this exact same thing of saying M-O-O-N spelled everything. And he pretty much wrote him into this book. Let's not forget, boys, you guys mentioned Of Mice and Men. And this is, and King has said this in numerous interviews, this is King's version of Lord of the Rings. And if you make the connection, you can definitely see it, especially when they start walking through the country. Adam, did you make that connection?
No, I never did. No, and this miniseries won't convince me of that. Maybe the book will, but no, for me.
Just because it's long and there's a lot of walking does not make you Tolkien.
Well, I mean, King has said Tolkien was one of his idols, and this was his version of Lord of the Rings. And I'll make the connections as we go. There are certain characters. I think Tom Cullen is our Frodo. I think that Trash Can Man is our Gollum. There are connections if you decide to dig deep.
I thought Tom was the Gollum because they both have some kind of mental illness. Gollum's got DID.
So Tom reveals that he can't read, making Nick's notes to him useless. M-O-O-N, that spells deaf and dumb, I guess.
I love that that is a part of that, though. That they still can't be it. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like that, too. Tom says that he doesn't want to stay here anymore. He needs to go to Kansas City with Nick, which Nick agrees to. Tom asks if they're going to go see Mother Abigail and not Randall Flagg. We then cut to another ominous scene in a cornfield as Stu shows up to Abigail's house shirtless. She says that she's the last hope as rats show up around Stu's feet. She then reveals that the rats are his, and Stu flees the scene.
Now we're getting graveyard shift references.
I didn't put that together, but you're right. Stu says that his dreams are driving him crazy, so he's going to go to Nebraska to see what they're about. Glenn agrees to go with and then gives some background on both Abigail and Randall Flagg. We then cut to Fran and Harold. They pull up in their double motorcycle, and Harold, of course, is apprehensive about Stu. Stu suggests that they all go to Nebraska together, which Harold disagrees with, saying that he doesn't like the look of Stu. Stu takes Harold aside and assures him that he doesn't want to cut in on what they have going on. He then brings some beer over, which Fran turns down, but Harold says that he still wants to go to Stovington, which Stu warns against. And this fucking love triangle is a lot of book two, which is why I say book two is probably the weakest part of this entire novel.
There's just no surprises to be had. I mean, you might as well learn Morse code the way this is telegraphed. It's spelled out in big letters that even Tom Collins can read it.
They see a dead body, which Harold vomits on while seeing it, and this seems to be enough to convince Harold that going to Stovington would be a bad idea. Meanwhile, Tom tells Nick that he doesn't want to go anywhere as his legs feel funny. So Nick goes in and puts on some deodorant, and he's approached by Julie Lowry, played by Shawnee Smith, making an appearance.
Freaking Smith!
Yes! 10 years before Saw.
Let's get Adam to sit up in his chair a little straighter.
Yeah, he was about to play another game, and he was thankful nobody was home to see him.
10 years before Saw, but this is what, about 7 years removed from The Blob?
Yep. This character in the book is actually a teenager, so she's playing a little older than the character is, but I love Shawnee Smith's energy when she's on screen. She brings a funness to this movie.
She's bringing what Nadine's not.
Correct. She has a bigger role in the novel, so I'm curious to see if next week's movie plays upon that.
Yeah, I almost wish they would have changed a little bit, because the way that, like, she's in it, and then she's sidelined, and that it just disappears, but you could have done at least a little, made this character a little better. But at least this scene here, it injects some energy.
Yeah, and you say they could have done this better, and that's not helped by the fact that she says the R word a little too much here, too.
Yeah
this is like It's like in certain movies where they use the F word.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Just that's all they can think of. But this kind of woke me up because I was starting to squirm in my seat a bit. I was starting to feel the length.
We don't even know with night two yet.
I know, but I did this all in one shot.
Oh, would not recommend that. Julie then tells Nick to get out, but she follows Nick to Tom, and Julie tells Tom that the medicine is actually poison. Nick then hauls off and slaps her before knocking her down. I am shocked that this was on ABC TV, boys.
Yes, what got Rob Lowe to commit to the role.
Oh, shit. Man, Rob Lowe's taking a beating in this podcast.
So is Shawnee. This is when I'm just like, oh, she's just a crazy bit. Where is she getting off with like this? It seems mean for no reason other than to be mean.
Julie says that it was all just a joke, but Nick's having none of it and shoves her off. Julie leaves saying that she's going to get both of them and cries on the street. And Tom reveals to Nick that Julie scared him. She gets on a building and starts shooting at them. Then we go to 50 miles outside of Pratt as Nick and Tom, they're drinking some water and catching their breath as they see a truck approach. And Nick is convinced that the people inside are probably nice like them. The truck stops and the driver, named Ralph Brettner, says that he's happy to see them. Tom introduces Nick as being deaf and dumb. And Ralph reads a piece of paper which finally teaches Tom his name. And this Ralph character, barely in this movie, but he plays a pretty big part in the actual novel.
Please moment.
Yeah, I agree.
Something about the way this is shot and played. I liked it. You got a way that Tom and Nick can communicate. It's sweet.
They throw their things in the truck and they take off. We then cut to Des Moines, Iowa, as Larry is belting a tune from inside a truck, and he's approached by Lucy Swan and the boy who she found in a supermarket. And again, this is another character. Big part in the novel, not too big in this miniseries. You only do so much.
Yeah, but you have 6.5 hours. I mean, how much can you cut out justifiably?
Yeah, 8 hours, actually. The only hour and a half after commercials. But yeah, you're right. But come on, if that was included here, you would have been like, oh, he's padding it too much. So where's the line there?
Yeah, but like at this point, just go all the way and include every single thing. You have the time to do so.
It's here where we find out that there are a series of explosions and some wind. And by morning, everything was gone, supposedly burned to the ground by the government. We cut back to Trash Can Man, who's still hearing voices and seeing crows flying away in his presence. Meanwhile, we go back to Mother Abigail, who gets her first series of people getting to her house, that of Ralph, Nick, and Tom. She says that time is short.
Not in this movie.
We cut to a dilly of a meal, as Nick says that he knew to come to Mother Abigail through his dreams, which also contain, as Ralph calls him, the other fella. Abigail says that the other fella, the dark man, is actually real. Nick writes that he doesn't believe in God, but Mother Abigail responds with, that doesn't matter, because God believes in you. Abigail tells Nick that she's been thinking some long thoughts, and that when all she had left was the home place, she decided that she'd hang on to the home place, and everyone else could have the rest. She also says that they need to travel to Boulder, Colorado, and warns that conflict is imminent. We then cut to Vegas, the city of sin, as people Flag has called upon are also starting to show up, and the final showdown is being set up, boys. Adam, it's a good thing to keep the evil people in Vegas, right? I mean, come on, is that too on the nose for you? Like, Vegas is the bad place?
Oh, it's extremely, like I put down here, that just, you just think Vegas is a den of sin. This is so far on the note. You might as well have Beetlejuice just jump out with a giant freaking flames in the bag in his head. I mean, it's maybe because of when this was written, right? I mean, that was what Vegas was. Though I guess for Stephen King, it was Atlantic City. But you got to update this a little bit. You got to do something with it. Because just to stick it in Vegas only because it's Vegas doesn't mean anything. Especially yeah. Nowadays.
Well, it's literally Sin City. That's why they decided to be that literal with it.
What's weird about this is it's not like these people are like having a good time. It's not like they're partying. If they do drugs, they're freaking killed. This is the most bizarre thing of bad people I've ever seen, this gathering. And King put this pretty well in an interview I read of him. What he said was, evil eventually will undo itself. So we're seeing Randall Flagg. He is head of this whole revolution that he has going on here. But eventually they all kind of turn on him and Randall Flagg kind of loses control. So in King's mind, evil will outdo itself.
Depends, but from a certain point of view.
All right, Obi-Wan.
I mean, this shit is literally the light side and the dark side, so that's not...
Yeah, you're right.
It's funny because, you know, you got the religious stuff here. Not an allegory, it's actual plot. But it's almost like extreme religious fascism, but instead of one side, it's the other side. They can't do the debauchery that they're in Sin City. I guess other than sex, but everything else is off the table? It just makes no sense.
We see a parade of some sort, and of course Garrus has to include a shot of the scenic view sign, as Tom Cullen puts the exclamation point on it by saying M-O-O-N, that spells parade. We cut to Ohio, as Stu is trying to perform some type of surgery on Mark, but they are unable to save him, and they bury him with a funeral. Franny then gets close to Stu while they're in the rain, and Harold is irritated that no one else is around to help him make a fire, and we cut to Stu fishing. He then approaches Fran, who tells him of her nightmares, which Stu is also having. He sits next to her and tells about the better dream that he had of Abigail, who told him you got to move them along faster. And boys, this is also when Stu finds out that Fran is pregnant.
And again, I cringed because I'm like, okay, so Stu is not, Anakin is not the chosen one, it's technically Luke.
Well, mm-hmm. I mean, here's the thing. This is not Stu's baby. This is the baby of the boy we never met when her and her dad are talking. This is Jess's baby.
Because of how poorly it's explained, I literally stopped and tried to figure out the math real quick because at least she gives a date.
Yeah.
I'm doing January. I'm like, well, this didn't start until June, which means she was pregnant, but I'm like, okay, here we go.
And of course, this means that she's just going to be another high school pregnancy statistic, as she says.
At 30 years old.
At 30 years old, yeah. This doesn't stop Stu from making his intentions known as he just makes out with her, which of course Harold sees, causing a bit of resentment in his eyes.
What? No. Didn't see this coming.
This character, again, is more hashed out in the book. He does have this resentment, but it's not all about the love triangle. He is really struggling with which side he wants to be on. He doesn't know whether he's going to be on Abigail's side or Flag's side. And in the book, he's also rotund, he's overweight, and he does have zits. Garrus did compromise by giving, and this is weird, he gave Nemec some butt pads, I guess, to put on there. They gave him a bit of a butt, so he looks a little bigger, so that when we do see him in better shape later, I guess. But I don't know, this character is just not as hashed out in this miniseries, and it pissed me off, actually, watching it this time.
The worst part is when they start to, I mean, he starts to go down the route of classic King Greaser villain. Greaser,
yes. For sure.
It's just like, fuck, I can't believe we're slipping down into that.
So Fran and Stu, they go tell Harold that she's pregnant, who says that he's jealous and maybe a little angry, but he responds that he loves her and that he owes Stu an apology. But we linger on Harold and see that his fingernails have broken the skin of his palm. We cut to Trash Can Man, who wakes up and is visited by Lloyd and the Rat Man. Oh, I love this character in the book. He gets maybe two scenes here, but in the book, he's really fun. He makes his way to Flag, who does a trick of turning a lighter into a necklace, and then offers him a job, saying that he's going to fulfill all his dreams. The rest of the group make their way to Mother Abigail, who says, "You're all welcome here, but there were more here before." Fran realizes that Harold is gone. We cut to Nadine, making her way to Flag in her dream, as he once again shows those red eyes of his, and then wakes up to find that she's being driven in a truck with Teddy Wayzak, played by none other than our screenwriter and bassist for this show's entire retrospective, Stephen King.
Well, I knew it was coming. I was just wondering when it was going to show up.
Yeah, I thought maybe King would have like a cameo, but no, this is a big, I'm not going to say he's a big character, but he is a pretty important character in the book. It's just funny that Garrus cast him in this role.
You say funny. That's he's in this movie and delivers a lot more lines than he ever should be allowed to. But
you're right.
He's not as bad as even some other people that are legitimate actors in this thing.
My favorite role. Well, we'll get to that when we get there. We cut back to Stu and his group as Glenn is concerned over what Mother Abigail is asking them to do and what she's selling them. This is why I love the Glenn character. The Glenn character isn't just blindly going with Mother Abigail's wishes. He's wondering, what the hell is she thinking? So that makes it a little bit of a conflict, right?
Yeah, as best they can, because you got to come up with stuff before the big showdown at the end.
Adam, did you like this?
I did, because at least not everybody's just marching in lockstep.
We then see Mother Abigail move a lawnmower around using the shine, I guess. I wonder if this is a stab at the lawnmower man as more of the group arrives.
It just popped me big. she's got a remote in her hand, but yeah, I lawnmower manned out.
Nadine gets out and is driven by Flag as he tells her to go to Mother Abigail, who senses bad things within her. She introduces herself as Nadine Cross, and she says that she looks tired, and Larry then stops her. He tells her hello, and then Nadine tells him to leave her alone. We see a huge scene of the electricity getting turned on, as there are cheers abound here. One of these people, Sue Snell, again, a bigger role in the book, but she's being played by Mick Garris' wife, so she just has a little bit of a mini role here. A lot of speaking parts in this movie. I'm so glad I didn't have to read the cast. Mother Abigail says that there was something within that woman this morning that she just doesn't like. Speaking of Nadine, we then cut to a town meeting as Stu takes the stand to an ovation. And he says that we're all going to have to get used to this again, huh?
Is that literally what the title is referring to?
There are so many things the title could refer to. It's a reference, I think, to maybe good taking a stand against evil. But this is just King having fun with the screenplay. This scene of them saying the Pledge of Allegiance.
Awkward.
Very awkward.
Might as well have had the freaking Team America theme song in the background.
I was hoping they would sing Baby Can You Dig Your Man, but it's not happening.
Of all the things that I've sung at church and done at church, I don't think Pledge of Allegiance was ever one of them.
Yeah, so clearly separation of church and state is not going to bleed over into this new society.
Most are going along with this, but some, like Nadine and Harold, they're not. In fact, it looked like they were flat out plotting. We then get a Mick Garris cameo. He's the one who calls out, "You go, Stu," or whatever he says. That's Mick Garris there. Instead of choosing a head of the council, Harold suggests that they remain one committee known as the Free Zone Committee, which is passed. And you know what, boys? I gotta say right now, all of this committee stuff, all of this putting this committee together is the majority of Book 3. Which is why...
All this Jedi Council crap? Yes,
this is a lot of that. We're breezing through this. You guys think it's long here? When I was reading this book, it's about 400 pages.
Oh my freaking God.
Yeah, it's a lot. And it was just too much. I needed something to happen. And it drags. I don't want to stay with these people. I want to stay with the evil people. I want to see the conflict build. But no, we're just seeing this committee being formed. And who's going to take this? Who's going to take that? Who's going to take this role? It's laborious, I got to say.
It just makes me think of, there's an episode of Family Guy where they decide that they're going to disband the government and they destroy the government, but then they need social services, so they decide what everybody's going to do, so then they end up reforming a government after they destroy the government. It's all I could think of with this. I'm like, you could have done something else with it, or just make this a three-nighter.
It's a big reason why I say I'm not one of those people who holds it as one of my top favorite Stephen King books. It's not. There are parts I really do love.
This committee, this town, this government, it doesn't play a role in what happens going forward. So I don't want to say it's ineffectual, because I mean it's a part of recovering from it, but for a translation, it's easy to cut.
Yeah, or at bare minimum, condensation.
We see that Mother Abigail left a note, and now she's gone. We hear the idea of sending spies to find out more about Randall Flagg, who could be planning to attack or nuke them. We cut to Larry, who finds his guitar up against the wall of the house as Nadine approaches him, and Lucy opens the door. This Lucy character, again, bigger role in the book, but she's pretty much a glorified cameo. And the only reason I know they're married, again, is because I read that book. You wouldn't know that by watching this series, but Lucy and Larry are in fact married.
Yeah, but to Matt's point, you got this much time, you can make some things a little more explicit.
Nadine wants Larry to talk to her outside. He does, and Nadine says that she came to say that she's sorry for the way she left him. And then said hello as she was just surprised to see him. They embrace as Lucy looks out the window. Nadine says it was a mistake to leave him, and she wants him to stay and make love to her. He throws her down and tells her it's too late for them as he has a wife now, and she ends up walking away while cackling. Awkward scene. Larry walks back into the house and tells Lucy that Nadine is gone now and that he loves Lucy. Meanwhile, Nadine is walking up the steps to what looks like the Nightmare on Elm Street house. And Flagg, yeah, Flagg tells her to go to Harold, but don't forget who you belong to. Stu sits down to eat and says as soon as they bring back Monday Night Football, he's going to be in redneck heaven. Unless he's a fan of the Jets, right, Matt? They talk about the possibility of Flagg having a nuke, and Glenn isn't too convinced that the scouts they send out will be back. They throw names out as Stu yells at Larry to get out if he isn't going to help. Nick stands up as we fade to Tom being lured to sleep using some kind of hypnosis.
Yeah, so apparently they have a mentalist in their group.
This is directly from the book. It shouldn't be in the series. It's bad. You're tricking the guy to help you.
Yeah, and why are you hypnotizing the guy with mental deficiencies? I'm sure he wouldn't take all that much convincing.
Mm-hmm. Stu talks to Tom and says that they need him to be the third scout. We then see corpses being picked up and Harold not really being able to stomach it as the corpses are just dropped off by a garbage truck. And, you know, given that this series is CBS All Access that we're going to discuss next week, they had all the leeway in the world to make these corpses as gross and disgusting as they wanted. I can't bear to fathom what they're going to do with that next week. Because this series was hampered by standards and practices. You only show so much there. What are they going to show next week?
Isn't the next show CBS?
That's what I said, CBS All Access.
I mean, did that air on broadcast television?
No, it was strictly their on-demand app.
Oh. So maybe they don't have those restrictions necessarily.
No, they don't. They can do whatever the hell they want. Nadine makes her way into Harold's house and introduces herself. And then we cut back to what I'm guessing is supposed to be a romantic dinner with Nadine wearing a red dress. They drink to friendship as she asks if he's planning on going out west. She kisses him and assesses that he's a virgin, to which she says that she is as well and it's going to stay that way. But that doesn't mean they still can't do stuff, which they do.
Damn, even in the apocalypse, you got blue balls.
I tell you, I've never.
That's the second time that he's one of the last men on Earth and been rejected. Mm. Maybe he does need to go to Vegas.
Poor guy. We cut to Boulder as we hear the disappearance of Abigail might be for the best. And this judge character. Now, this judge character is funny. Well, I shouldn't say funny because it's actually kind of tragic. He was originally cast as a different actor, but that actor got sick. So they cast Ozzie Davis. Now, people might know Ozzie Davis from a lot of Spike Lee's work. Or, if you're of Matt's generation, you might know him as John F. Kennedy, if you saw Bubba Hotep. But he's also the husband of Ruby Dee, and they thought it might be too on the nose to cast him because of that. But he only gets a couple scenes here. He plays a much bigger role in the book. I like seeing Ozzie Davis here, though. It was kind of fun to see him. Matt, you recognize him from Spike Lee's work, right?
Oh, God, yeah. And Bubba Hotep, of course.
Yes.
I mean, look, you have Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in your movie. Nothing should be off the table as far as, well, that'd be too ridiculous for someone to be in. But around this time, wasn't doing a whole, like, Grumpy Old Men, The Client, so he was still making movies. Mm-hmm. So at least he wasn't retired, and then this was like a surprise role.
Adam, have you seen Bubba Hotep?
Not just because I've heard so much about it, I've never gotten around to it. But this is an actor I genuinely like, and glad to see him here.
Judge accepts the assignment of being a scout. We then cut back to Nadine and Harold, who both say they enjoyed whatever the hell they just did. And I love the creative camera work that hides the nudity here, very Austin Powers-esque.
Yeah, they play hide the sausage for 2 minutes.
Yes. Nadine starts getting under Harold's skin, though, as he's talking about how Stu stole Fran and how he was kicked off the committee. She concludes by saying that there's someone out west who will never betray you, and then requests him to drink his wine.
Obi-Wan and the council don't trust me.
We cut to Estes Park, where Stu and Nick drop off Tom Cullen, and we get a little goodbye scene as Tom takes off on his bike. We then go to the community hospital as Fran is being examined. She says that she's gained 5 pounds or so, and the doctor says that the baby is going to be just fine. This scares Fran, as she says that, who's to say that our babies are going to be immune to the flu? We didn't see this weird scene of a corpse talking to Harold, calling him a wild card, as he sees dynamite in a storage facility. I think at this point, Mick Garris has lost control. I think this movie really falls off the hinges around this time.
I guess it goes off the rails because it doesn't go far enough. It's definitely more heightened than what we've seen. Because the first one, I feel like all four of these episodes are trying to play into a different subgenre. The first one's a pandemic movie. The second one is like a kind of like the Road Warrior in a lot of ways without the action. Mm-hmm. This one is more freaking Star Wars prequels. All this Jedi Council nonsense, and and part four is a Pureflix movie. So yeah, at least you're getting some variance.
Adam, you were really with that first night. How are you feeling at this point?
Yeah, I feel like there's a pretty big separation between night one, and then as we're going along, I'm just like, what the hell happened to this movie that I was enjoying, or this miniseries? We're taking the road less traveled, and I kind of wish that we would get back on a proper path, because these detours are not doing us any favors. I need to take a stand to the screenwriter and say, write me a better script, because this shit's falling off to Matt's point. I don't want to say it's going off the rails, but it can't find the road to get to where it's got to go.
I got to say, too, I didn't even mention this at the beginning, which I always do, but this thing had a $30 million budget, which for 1994 TV is actually pretty high, but I still don't think they had enough to work with what they were trying to tell.
Yeah, especially with the makeup on Flag. Yes. Every time they use that. And they try their best to put him in shadow and do some more close-ups, but that part is never convincing. And I know they tried to save money with the cornfield, but even that loses its luster really quick.
Yeah, I feel like I don't want to say it's low. I just think it's used inconsistently. The spots where you saved money is obvious, and the parts where you used it, are like, okay, this looks good. And then when you ran out of money but realized that everybody showed up on set, it's almost like Mick Garris went, oh, shit, we got to shoot something.
So you're saying it's a Rob Lowe budget.
Flag approaches Harold with a smiley face mask telling him to do it as Harold wakes up.
I just saw Freaky Eyes not too long ago, and that's where my brain went.
Harold tells Nadine that she looks tasty and juicy as they make out yet again. We then cut to Indian Springs Airport space as Tom tries integrating. He takes the toolbox inside and then spots Trash Can Man getting a plane ready to fly. And again, boy, they use a lot of the R word here, and that's very unfortunate.
I can't imagine they do this in the 2021.
Oh, God, I don't think so. We cut to Harold working on some dynamite. As Nadine comes down and interrupts him, he tells her to take
a look. Because he's a nerd, he knows how to make bombs.
I'll get to this bomb here in a bit. There's a story behind it. He tells her to take a walk because he doesn't know how old the dynamite is, but it just might blow up as he works on it. In other words, make like a library and book. We then go to the betrayal as Nadine walks in with the dynamite and sets it in the closet. Harold tells Nadine that they're pretty much screwed here. And we see Larry playing on a piano as another meeting commences. More of these great meetings. And we're seeing that Mother Abigail comes back and she doesn't look like she's in the best shape. Harold is yelling at Nadine a lot as they prepare to set off the dynamite. All right, let's talk about this. So I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast that this book was one of the few times that King really had writer's block. He doesn't outline his books. He just kind of takes the characters where he takes them as he writes. And at this point, he had gotten them to Colorado. He had gotten them to settle, but he had no idea what to do with these characters. And one day he was out on a walk, and as he was walking, it came to him, I'll just blow them up. And so that's what he came up with. He came up with this bomb. Matt, how do you feel about that write-out?
I know cop-out's a bit of a stretch, but it definitely feels like a bad case of shorthand writing.
Yeah, it feels like there wasn't a plan. At least outline everything that you're going to go. If you get yourself into a block, I mean, look, it's his book, it's his choice, but I don't know. Have a plan for what you're going
to
do.
Ralph says that they need to go now as the dynamite is spotted, and Harold says that he's doing this at his own free will as he blows the building up. Stu finds Fran unconscious as she dreams of walking into Mother Abigail, who says that Fran's there to do God's will, which is to not form committees, but to finish the job. Abigail goes on to say that it's time for her to make her stand, as we cut to Stu standing over her and Fran wakes up. See, Matt, the stand takes many meanings in this.
Yeah, especially because she can't get out of bed.
Yes. And then we hear that Nick is dead, so no more Rob Lowe, as well as other names that died in the explosion with 20 or so wounded, and Harold and Nadine being the ones responsible. Abigail tells the men in the room that they need to keep the clothes that they're wearing and head to Vegas to face Flag, the creature from beyond, and with God's help, they will all stand. And this, of course, ends up being Abigail's death scene. Larry tells Lucy goodbye and swears that he's going to try and come back. Meanwhile, Fran gets Stu to tell her that he loves her. All the guys, including Kojak, start their journey as Fran prays for their safe return. So here we go, boys. This is the Lord of the Rings part. We gotta take this journey.
Yep. Just like Gandalf returning from who knows where the fuck did Abigail go to come back from?
Yeah, she just kind of took the walk in the woods, pretty much.
She hopped on an eagle.
And boys, all that I detailed there, that is all of night three. How do we feel about night three?
I felt good that I was more than halfway, and I was curious to see how this all ended, because they teased the bombs and I know they're building up to a fight, so I was really curious to see how this would play out.
I want to know why and what they're doing in Vegas, because I understand the people here that are making their stand. I get Mother Abigail's side. I guess I understand the light side of the force. I just have no idea what the hell's going on the other side or why or what. I'm waiting to hear that the Man in Black either caused the virus or got it to release. It's starting to get unfulfilling because the setup was great, and it's almost like we had no idea what to do after the setup.
So we get to the final part, simply titled The Stand. Harold and Nadine, they're riding along on their motorcycles until Harold has a vision of Flag and gets thrown all over a guardrail. And Matt, am I the only one who thought of Nightmare on Elm Street Part 4 here? Freddy just kind of shows up in the middle of the street.
Very much.
Great stunt here, though. I like this stunt a lot. Adam, you're really big on practicals. This was crazy good, huh?
Yeah, it was good. I was surprised. I didn't see this coming. And look, don't rub another man's rhubarb. I mean, he got what he deserved.
Stu gets a vision of Harold being in trouble. He's screaming, help me, as Nadine looks over the edge and sees the crow before turning away and taking off on her bike, and Harold is just screaming.
Yes, suddenly in part four, Stu frickin' gets shine. The shine out of nowhere.
We then see Judge driving. He stops to see a corpse hanging with drug addict written on a sandwich board around his neck. Meanwhile, Lloyd, he reiterates to keep an eye on their surroundings and then attends to a pretty young gal in satin sheets. And this character of Dana, oh my god, plays a big role in that. She has a decent role here in Night 4, but she's a great character in that book. Lloyd's goons, they spot Judge driving and pursue him. Judge grabs his gun, and it's on like Donkey Kong. He gets out and shoots one goon before being taken out by a machine gun. So here's the end of Ozzie Davis.
That was anticlimactic.
Very much so. Flag then takes out Sam Raimi.
Okay, this caught me so off guard.
Same here, as Lloyd is smiling in the satin sheets. Phone rings, and he's told that it's time to take out their number two spy, who is Dana, as I mentioned, and she says that she's faked it every time. They talk her out of the room that she's hiding in, and then send her to Flag. And the way he's just lying down, trying to be subtle and evil. Ugh, Sheridan's just so terrible in this role. Ugh. I watch this and I think, what if McConaughey played in this movie? Was he around to play him here?
Well, when did Texas Chainsaw 4 come out?
Same year.
Okay, so he was around, but I doubt they would have cast him.
Yeah.
This is when you really need some menace or something. It's inconsistent. But also, this is when I start to get upset that I feel like Flag, he's the emperor with no clothes. Everything that happened around the judge and his lack of control, I'm like, so what's the what behind this? I'm not getting it. To your point, though, with this character, was it Gina?
Dana.
Dana. I feel like there was something really there that was cut out. And you said she's bigger in the book.
Mm-hmm.
For everybody that's kind of overlooked that goes into Vegas, I feel like there's just really something that got left out, which is a shame. Because you could tell there's something compelling for somebody that had to do everything she did to be that spy. And this is where the mass transitions over and over here are just like, oh, fuck this.
There's a big difference with the Dana character that I'll get to here in a bit. But you're right. I think of all characters to sacrifice, this was not one to do it with. So Flag tries sending her to tell the other group that they mean no harm. And then Dana tries denying that Abigail is dead. As she leaves, he asks her about the Moon Man. She doesn't tell him, and then stabs him in the gut. He laughs and then morphs into a demon before Dana sacrifices herself on a shard of glass. Boy, this does not work in a 90s television setting.
This wouldn't work in any setting, quite frankly.
It's almost like they had set it up to throw herself off the balcony and then went, oh, no, wait, hang on.
Well,
no,
funny you mention that. Funny you mention that, because that's exactly the way it happens in the book. He pretty much wills her to do it in the book. It's a very tense scene. Here, they just kind of get through it.
I don't get that I want him to be so charismatic that he's talking her off the ledge and then loses the connection. Who was following this guy and for what? Yeah. There's no there. The Crow is a more interesting character to watch than Randall Flagg.
Everything with this character is a misfire. If I didn't know what I know, I would think that this is one of the biggest wet bag villains that King has ever written.
Well, he's had this villain in his head since he was in high school. He wrote the first line of The Gunslinger as he was a senior in high school. So this has been his big bad in almost, you mentioned it, Matt, throughout all the Dark Tower books, pretty much. This has been him, and it's not portrayed as that way here. He's just kind of there. Julia, the Shawnee Smith character, she finds Tom and smiles before storming off. Meanwhile, Harold wakes up and writes a letter apologizing, saying that he was misled before shooting himself. Boys, this is an incel if there ever was one, right?
Oh, boy, yeah.
Think about it that way, but yeah, a good point.
Stu says that he knows Harold is dead, and he has no idea how he knows it. Because you have the shine, dummy! We cut to Nadine, whose bike has seemingly run out of gas. We then see Trash Can Man. He's in Indian Springs, screaming for the voices to leave him alone before taking off, if not before leaving a bomb that blows up the whole facility. Every time we cut to Trash Can Man, I'm like, why?
I keep thinking of backyard wrestling promotion. That's one of the wrestlers. That's what it sounds like. Oh, it's the fucking It's Always Sunny Trash Man, Danny DeVito's character.
Oh shit.
We go back to Nadine, who's walking the road before hearing the voice of Flag, who pulls her toward the mountains. She sees him walking out of the fire and making out with her, and then setting her on a bed. He morphs once again, saying it's too late to say no, and we get more cries in ecstasy as the red moon looms overhead. This demon makeup is pretty bad.
Yeah, I've been to haunted houses that have better makeup than this.
And of course, in the book, this is total rape. It's kind of implied here, but it's tough to show it on 94 TV. Adam, how do you feel about the makeup here?
Every time I see it, it keeps getting worse. This whole scene, it goes from implied because she says no, and then, oh, it's too late to say no.
And of course, Flag's driving away singing, "What, boys? Baby, can you dig your man?" We cut back to the group as Glenn is the man yelling at Clouds, just the negative Nancy of the group, which I love. And we see them take to the road, complete with Larry's guitar. Boys, I don't know if you guys have ever walked with a guitar. It's very heavy. Why is Larry carrying this fucking thing on this huge walk? I don't know. It's a weird thing to get mad at, I know, but...
Yeah, it's called... That's like when people go hiking and they get a list of supplies, but they don't grab the water.
We go back to Vegas as Julie tells Lloyd about Tom, and Lloyd reports to Flag. But Flag doesn't want to hear from Julie. He's concentrated on taking Nadine up to the suite. We hear another rendition of Baby Can You Dig Your Man by Flag as the doorbell rings. It's Lloyd, and Flag introduces Nadine as his wife, and she seems about as cold as many of my exes.
It's important to notice, too, that Nadine's transformation physically throughout this, I'm bought into why. Other than her just every time that she gets contacted by Flag in her mind, it's a little more white. It's a little more harrowing of a look. But it doesn't give us any more of an explanation than that. But I like to see her transform from night 1 to 4.
But God, that fright wig is god-awful, though.
See, she looks hot.
You would think she looks hot. Well, you watch Just Shoot Me, though. That's where you know her from.
Yes.
Flag says that he wants the group coming from Boulder to be brought before him, and then asks about Julie. Lloyd says she thinks she spotted the third spy, as Flag loses it on Lloyd and proceeds to tear the room apart. There's a way to get your point across. Just fucking lose your temper.
Spill my drink, you better make me another one.
I do kind of like this, though, because I like seeing the evil get unhinged. I see where King's coming from on this. Flag's losing control, and that is actually kind of cool to see, though it's not really executed that well.
Yeah, it's demonstrating it, but not in a methodical way. It's like, oh, we're at the end, so we got to make this happen, because we're running out of real estate.
I wish we would have seen something in the meantime. You know, other than a few little promises, I've said it all along, I just don't see what's captivating about him. So if we would have seen him be charismatic and then now he's losing his shit, he would have had an arc, but we don't have that.
That's a good point. It makes it ineffective, doesn't it? When you don't see him as strong as he was before.
I just don't see him as that powerful.
Flag asks Lloyd how the drink was. He then laughs and tells Lloyd that he has had a yard of guts, as he says. Lloyd says that the name of the guy is Tom Cullen, and Flag says that he's fine as fiddlesticks. But Lloyd says that he and a few of their people are worried about him. Flag says there's nothing to worry about because it is he who has the power. Right, Palpatine?
Yes.
Nadine says they're coming back for him. We're on the home stretch here, boys. Nadine says they're coming back for him and that everything Flag is building here is now falling apart. She then climbs on the ledge and jumps. We go back to the nuclear storage facility as Trash Can Man talks about the big fire, and we're seeing some nuclear warheads. We cut to blood being cleaned off the sidewalk, so Nadine jumps. Boy, he's got that cleanup right there, doesn't he?
Yeah, he might as well be standing there with a mop.
Exactly.
Gotta hurry up and clean it up. It's Biff's casino she jumped off of.
Biff's casino.
It's Biff's casino.
Lloyd is hearing that some of the others are cutting loose near South America, and it might be time for them to split.
Wait, there's people in other parts of the world? Holy shit, it would have been nice to show that in the course of 6 hours.
You know, it's implied in that book that this is going on worldwide, but King is such an American-centric writer that I don't think he felt the need to go to different places to see what's going on out there. We have enough going on here, but I definitely could have used at least a little bit of explanation of that.
Just something. That's all. Just something. Because this isn't set in the 50s, 60s, 70s where media is restricted. Mm-hmm. So just something would have been nice.
Lloyd says that he's sticking around because Flag changed him for the better. He also trusted him. We move on to the Nevada-Utah border as Tom overhears some talk about whores, with one of these guys being played by John Landis, of all people.
Yeah, because if there's one person I buy as a hitman, it's John Landis.
Another one.
I mean, if he told someone, unless he told them to get in a helicopter to go save me.
God, make that reference again. John Landis is one of Mick Garris's best friends, so he did include him here. John Landis put him in Thriller. Mick Garris is actually one of the zombies in Thriller. We go on to Utah as the group walk the plains and find out where they need to go. Stu is first, and he stumbles a bit before making it to the top, and then he stumbles to the bottom, shattering his leg. This again was a big part of that novel. Bateman shows up with some cokes and pills. Stu says that he's going to stay as he needs to stay behind. Abigail said that one would fall, but Larry is done hearing about God's will, as I'm sure my two other colleagues are as well. Boys, how do you feel about taking Gary Sinise out of this with just a fall off this bank?
I've seen him survive a lot. He lost his legs at Forrest Gump, and he's still out there fighting the good fight.
This is why he's yelling at God in a rainstorm. A boat. It's just not done well. I like the choice novel in the story to take him out, because, of course, he's going to be the one at the end. So you take out your leader, but he's not out. It's just done fucking lazily as I've fallen down hills over here, that's all. But, yeah.
Stu tells Larry that he needs to take on Flag without him. Bateman tells Stu goodbye, and Stu says, let's just leave it at that. Hey, at least Stu has Kojak, and these two actually do have a good relationship in that book. It's more played up in that book than in this movie, but I like that Kojak kind of stays behind here.
I like that inclusion, yeah.
We cut to Kanosh, Utah, as the trek continues, and Kojak brings Stu more sticks to put on the fire. Stu tells the Sky that he misses Fran. As we go back to the group, and they are right near the border, they join hands and make their way toward the patrol.
Okay, they might as well fucking sing Kumbaya.
Right. Glenn's belted down and tells Larry that it's almost over for them. They're put in cuffs and taken for a ride to jail. We see
on the outskirts of Vegas, being green as the hills of fucking Marin County. There is no Vegas to be found within 100 miles of this place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as somebody who lives outside of Vegas, it's straight fucking desert out here. So.
And to the leader of security, if you don't have to wear a suit and tie in Las Vegas, why would you?
Yeah, I know. We see Bateman talking to a cockroach, which gets crushed by Flag. He introduces Glenn to Lloyd, who says that he can fix Glenn's arthritis. All Glenn needs to do is ask. Flag then says that he's decided to let Glenn go, but Glenn says that he won't go without his friends. But if he wants them to be let go, Glenn needs to ask on his knees. Glenn says that all Flag is another cockroach. Flag tells Lloyd to shoot him, which Lloyd refuses to do. Glenn starts telling Lloyd to turn the tables on Flag, but Lloyd caves in and blast Glenn through the bars. Glenn says that it's all right, as he doesn't know any better. I did like this scene, even though I hated seeing Glenn go.
Completely agree. Hated seeing him go. I actually think it's a pretty effective scene.
Mother Abigail tells Stu to wake up. He pulls himself to the top of the cliff, but once again falls back down. And here's when Tom shows up, telling Stu to take hold of his hand. Tom then helps Stu to the top, and he tells him that his dreams told him to double back. He asks Stu if he's sick and says that he needs to get him inside somewhere. So Tom's the hero here.
Better be a son of a bitch, because Mama Abigail loves you.
But in this whole good versus evil, the fact that we're stuck on getting Stu out of this embankment, just, I don't know. There's just something wrong with that. We cut back to Vegas as the group is taken in a van, apparently being driven by Joker's men. There are riots brewing on the streets. They do us all a favor and break Larry's guitar as Julie spits in Larry's face. A lot of spitting in this
series. Got uniforms and banners and branding and shit all on the street. Weird day.
They are tied up as Flag and Lloyd take center stage to a huge ovation. Boy, this stuff looks familiar, doesn't it? This was scary to see. They are given final words before Flag reads a statement declaring the men as insurrectionists and sentence them to death. Whitney shows up on stage trying to stop the executions, only to get shot with some kind of energy bolt shot by Flag, which gives new meaning to "my lips are sealed." We didn't see Trash Can Man show up with a nuclear warhead. And you know what I thought of, boys, while watching this? This is what a cat does, right? A cat brings you a dead mouse to kind of make you feel impressed. Adam, did you get that?
Yes, they do.
Yes. Julie goes down to the energy screaming, "It's a bomb!" Crowd starts to disperse as the energy rises in the form of Mother Abigail. She tells the men they done good before the bomb goes off. Oh boy.
This, these effects, they don't pass muster in 1994.
No.
But to have the literal hand of God.
Yes.
Joe, I did not expect this in a Stephen King anything. To literalize this way, you got a lot of choices. I can't say I can agree with this one.
Yeah, Hal Jordan would look at that and go, "That's stupid," because it looks like a Green Lantern construct.
Boys, this is straight from the book too. This is how he literalizes it.
Well, it ties into he can't end a book to save his life.
You're absolutely right. I completely agree with you. Tom and Stu, they see the explosion, and Tom declares it to be the end of Las Vegas and the end of Randall Flagg. This is how they end the good versus evil war, huh? They just blow it up.
Yeah, there's no debate. There's no philosophy. Yeah. It's just resort to violence.
Exactly.
Clearly, not everybody in Vegas was a bad person. But they're all dead now.
They're all dead. Larry, Glenn, and Ralph, they make their sacrifice in the name of saving humanity, as they say. Stu and Tom, they get the car to start, and Stu says that he thinks they got the break they needed to get home. They stop at a lodge, and Tom tries giving him peanut butter and jelly, which he won't eat.
Oh, when? Spells peanut butter and jelly.
We get another dream. Boy, I haven't seen this many dreams since I watched the whole Nightmare on Elm Street series. They are visited by Nick in this dream, who can now talk. He says that he knows what to do as they leave the dream, but this wakes Stu up. Tom gives Stu some water, and we cut to Tom on a bench crying. Bojack comes out, followed by Stu. He tells Stu that he doesn't even remember what Nick looks like anymore, even though he was his best friend. Stu says he wouldn't be alive if it wasn't for Tom, and they start heading home. We cut to the Boulder Free Zone as Teddy, Stephen King, he says that the winter is here. Stu and Tom show up in a snowplow, and a reunion commences. Teddy says that the baby has come early, but bad news, boys, it has the flu. Stu goes to Fran, and he then clarifies it's not a dream she's having. They hug, and she says that they can start thinking about starting over. She asks why they did what they did. He says that at least they have each other. The doctor comes in and says that he believes the crisis has passed and the baby is going to live. So somehow, some way, this flu just kind of flew over this baby, huh?
Yeah, or I looked at it as, it's kind of set up at the very beginning. The next generation have got some immunity to it.
Oh boy, this shit's hokey.
You know, we gave the Shining miniseries trouble with how that ended. This isn't much better.
No.
Hey, seeing them pull up in that snowplow, I thought we were going to the Overlook for a minute.
Yeah. Good call.
Well, I was thinking of Dreamcatcher.
Oh, God. Don't ever think of Dreamcatcher. We're going to have to eventually. They name the baby Abigail, and the doctor calls her a miracle. They swear to take care of her as Lucy shows up pregnant as well. She says that she's sure when the end came, Larry ended up on his feet. She says even if Larry's gone, she has his baby, which will have to be enough to get her through it. Oh, boy. And speaking of hokey.
Oh, God.
Abigail shows up in an image saying that the baby is beautiful while not even looking at the baby, by the way. And then we get
she looks like Blind Al from the Deadpool movies.
And if it's not hokey enough, we get a montage of those who passed.
Oh my God, it's like a freaking Oscar in memoriam segment.
Like I'm watching the floating head at the beginning of Dune. Like, and not the current Dune.
The David Lynch one.
Oh, fuck.
Better one.
It's. Yeah. It's almost nice to remember those that came and those that sacrificed so that these people could stand. But you got to do this a better way.
They had 50 million people watching this fucking thing. They didn't care. They had the audience. Stu asks if people can change. And then Sylvester Stallone shows up and goes, everybody can change. To which Fran says, while they don't know, the baby does. We then have a slow fade on Abigail Goldsmith as credits roll on night 4 and the finale of The Stand, boys. Oh, boy. What a summarization. On a scale of 1 to 10, what do we give The Stand? Adam.
It was fine. 8 on 10. Move on. No. I got to say, for a miniseries that I was not looking forward to at all, just because of the length of the book, I was pleasantly surprised through a lot of it. I think night 1 is obviously the standout.
Standout.
That was unintentional, but it stands on its own as a good beginning to the story. It sets up a lot. You understand this, even if you don't understand the stakes, you know what happened, and it's pretty damn frightening. Even if you weren't a populace that just lived through a pandemic, 99.4% of Earth wiped out due to the flu, and shit, that's frightening. I like the setup of the characters. I like the different types that we have. So I think it starts amazingly strong. But then the walk downhill begins, and it keeps going downhill from that night. And I think that's to the detriment of the overall story. We don't get a clear reason as to why there's good versus evil, other than there's just good versus evil. Stephen King is working out some stuff in his early works. Obviously, angels, demons, corn, good, bad, and some of it's done really well. Some of it is really not. I think the acting is some of the best we've seen in this King retrospective so far. I think the directing is done pretty damn well, and I like what we have through a lot of it. I wish our villain was more captivating. I wish he was scarier. I wish he was more charismatic. I wish his mask did not look like something that I could buy from the reject bin at Party City. The villain deserves better if he's going to be the big bad through all of King's oeuvre. But overall, this is a story that I was impressed with way more than I thought I would be, even if it ends extremely flat. I'm glad that I saw it. I'm going to give it a 6. I don't think it's very good because it peaks on night one, and I think that's a problem. But I'm actually impressed because I didn't think that they could bring something so big in relatively well. And I think they did a good job. So 6 on 10, and I'm giving that a favorable 6.
All right, a 6 on 10 from Adam. After you were kind of high on night one, I was expecting it to be a little higher, but we'll take a 6. Matt, what about you, sir?
God damn, he took a lot of my points. It is disappointing that the best part is the first installment, and I do think it's a steady decline to the point where the last one is kind of a dud. But Stephen King is not known for having the best of resolutions, but I thought this was going to be the outlier because of how dense this is. And dense is the right word. This could have been very unwieldy to the point where it could be almost conceived as unfilmable. But I give Garris some credit. This is pretty well directed, especially by comparison to The Shining. But there are too many missteps, and I think the villain and everything with him is just a major red flag, to use that joke, because a pirate flag is more menacing than how Randall Flagg is portrayed in this movie. And it's not just him. His whole like perspective feels very short-sighted and not explored, which is inexcusable given this is 6 hours of my fucking life I had to devote to this. And I'm going to do it again next week. So it's good. It's pretty, pretty, pretty good. But I can't go any higher than a 6 just because it's so long.
All right, a 6 from Goudreau. You guys did take a lot of my points as well, but I'll go ahead and summarize this by saying, again, unlike a lot of people, this is not one of my favorite Stephen King novels. This is not one of my favorite Stephen King properties. But this meant a lot to me as a teenager watching this with my father, as Adam knows. That meant a lot to me. And we were able to talk about it together. And I will admit, I have a lot of nostalgia for this movie. I do think this is some of the best directing of Mick Garris' career. I do think this, like Matt, I feel like this is better directed than The Shining. I think for a miniseries that was filmed over 50 days and he had to keep these 100-plus roles together, I think he holds it together rather well. I think it is undone by a lot of the writing. And I say that as an obvious huge fan of the person in charge here. Night 4 does fall off the hinges, but I will say Night 1 is very good. I think that is the horror aspect of this movie, and I think Night 2 is the gathering that it's starting to fall, but I think it holds itself pretty well together. And I think a lot of this is also due to a star on the rise at this point that we didn't even know, named Gary Sinise, who I think is pretty good. I think a lot of the acting here is very good. I think this was event television for a reason. The Tuesday non-Roseanne Barr night notwithstanding, I think this was event television and people flocked to it for a reason. I gravitated to this, but the book is not as good as its reputation, and this miniseries is, it holds together okay, but I'm also on the side of the makeup was pretty bad, and the final battle is just kind of a mess given the 1994 TV budget that it had. I will go one higher than you guys just because of nostalgia I have for it. I will give it a 7. I do think any Stephen King fan needs to watch it, because I do think that there are parts of this that are some of his best writing and some of the best execution, but there's also some pretty bad stuff as well. So 7 out of 10 for me for The Stand. This was the only Stand media for many years. And then 2020 rolled around, and a guy by the name of Josh Boone, who did a movie called The Fault of Our Stars, which I really liked. And then he did a movie I promised I would never talk about again, which we'll eventually have to, called New Mutants, which is still the only 0 of 10 I've ever given. Boys, this is going to be a higher episode arc. We are diving deep into The Stand. What are you expecting in the modern retelling of it? Matt, is there stuff to build on here?
I think there's stuff to improve on, certainly. But I don't really want to watch this in modern day because of what we lived through, our echoing reality in the worst ways. So I'm sure, not going to guarantee it's an improvement, but I'm also not going to be too optimistic. But I am going to make sure to not drink as much coffee as I did, so I'm not getting up to use the bathroom every 30 minutes. But I may have to if this thing is a slog.
Adam, as somebody who liked this more than you were expecting, what are you expecting next week when we get Josh Boone's rendition of The Stand?
I think I'm glad we're getting a director that made one of the better X-Men movies. I know who some of the cast is. I tried to avoid it, but I know who the villain is. And I know who some of the other actors are. That makes me excited. Other than that, I think this is going to be stretched to the point that we're going to wish we were only watching a six-hour version. That's where my worry is. I think they're going to focus on the wrong things to make better. And I think it's going to be at the misstep of what could be a good apocalyptic story. But we'll see.
I don't know much, but what I will say is, while King was the sole screenwriter of this, he is involved in next week's series only as a producer, but he does write an episode as well, as does his son. His son is pretty involved in the telling.
He's a damn good writer.
Yeah, in the telling of next week's series. So that gives me a little bit of hope. I am not a big Josh Boone fan, as I've mentioned, but I think the styles could mesh. And look, when this was released, again, it was the end of 2020, not a good time for the world in general. And I held off watching it for a long time because of that. I was the exact same way as Matt was. So it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see a retelling of it. It'll be interesting to hear my colleagues' opinion on it, because I am coming in like them, pretty cold. But until next week, when we discuss The Stand 2020, it's a righteous podcast. Baby, can you dig your podcast? Thank you, boys.
Tom, can you say that back to us?
Go and watch. Then come back and tell.
Tell what?
How many people? How many guns? Did I see the Batman from your dreams?
It's really good, Tom.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
I mean, I tried not to hear what God had to tell me, but you see all the good it done.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice. And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Wonderful! Have more traitors in our midst!
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
I was looking through the rearview mirror and I'd see him just sitting there grinning at me.
Please visit and check out our Percolated Media Facebook page to get an advance look at what the boys will be reviewing that week, as well as other things such as Matt and Garrett's wrestling podcast, what the site has in store for the future, some periodically done written reviews, and so much more.
I'm sorry. He's been traumatized.
Haven't we all?
Message us, give us your thoughts. Visit and share. We greatly appreciate interacting with you, our listeners.
Hey! How's it hanging?
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including the Planet of the Apes franchise, the Mad Max movies,
the Exorcist films, the movies of the Alien franchise,
Jurassic Park, and so many more.
Why can't we be friends?
Fuck off!
Why can't we be friends?
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Very good at its job, too. Too good.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
Y'all take care of that old-timer. Them summer calls are the worst.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
country don't mean dumb.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
They're coming for you, you know.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
You come see me, Nick. You and all your friends. You got to hurry, though.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
A whole series of explosions on the west side of town where the tank farms are. And then later that night there was a wind, and by morning the rest of the city was gone. I'd say it was set.
You think somebody deliberately burned Des Moines to the ground?
Yes.
Everyone's staring at. Get them out of here. Okay, get them out of here right now.